Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. Huh. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I bring you precious contraband and ancient tales from distant lands.
All right, all right, all right. Good morning, everyone. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline Studio, 18 stories of a beautiful downtown Chicago. It is a Tuesday morning, 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. Get your requests in now. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Yeah. Hey, coming up, very excited to welcome comedian, actor, writer, podcaster, Paul Scheer is going to join us. You know him from Black Monday. He was in The League. He worked on Veep. He's been in a ton of movies. He does a lot of great podcasts, including How Did This Get Made? And they're going to be doing a live version of that podcast, How Did This Get Made? Saturday, September 7th at the Chicago Theater at 7:30 and 10 p.m. And we'll tell you all about that and all about the other stuff that he's been working about. Very, very, very funny guy, and I'm very excited to get him on the show. So Paul Scheer will be joining us in just a few minutes. We're going to talk about some sports mascots a little bit later on. My main man, Tommy Hawk, won best NHL mascot. And I'm very excited for Tommy, but I'm worried that Gritty might come after him. I'm a little concerned about Tommy Hawk's safety, considering Gritty's an insane mascot from the Philadelphia Flyers. We'll talk about some Guinness Book of World Records that just debuted today in history. We are also going to talk about some of the most insufferable movie characters of all time. So that and lots more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. And also subscribe to our podcasts. Every single second of every single show is podcast, and you can subscribe. It's free. Go to iTunes or any place you get your podcasts. Look up the Nick D Show. Do the subscribing. It'll automatically be sent to you to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So there you go. On this Tuesday morning, let me say hello to my great producer, Tom Hush. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Nick. How are you doing?
All right. How are you?
Very good. Very very excited for Paul Scheer.
Yeah, he's great.
He's a big fan, and I'm a big fan of his. Loved Human Giant when I was a young man.
Yep. No, he's a funny guy. Very, very funny guy. Very talented and very entertaining in the podcast world as well. And the live podcast that he's going to do along with June Diane Raphael and Jason Mantzoukas is going to be great. It's Saturday, September 7th at the Chicago Theater. We'll get all the details on that coming up when we talk with Paul. All right. In the newsroom, it's Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Hey, good morning, sir.
How are you, buddy?
Wrong button.
What happened there?
What's going literally on? Push the side of my board instead of the button. Yeah, I'm good.
Now you got to press the button.
That's
what makes it work.
Makes the sound. I'm good, sir.
Yeah. All right, good. You're in the newsroom all morning long. Cubs come back today. They're playing the Mets in New York. And, man, they got to start doing something. They've lost five in a row. Mets are a tough team. So, you know, come on now. I don't need this aggravation. So, anyway. All right. Vic.
Yeah.
Do you ever get into the Guinness World Book of Records? You ever read it?
Oh, man. For a while I was, because I was a little fascinated with, you know, with you, and at the time you had a certain very popular traffic reporter who was holds a world record, and I did not. And Dan Shagru
had a world record too. At one time, everybody except for Vic working on the show was part of a Guinness World Record.
But at least they never really brought it up, Tom.
No, not too often. But yeah, no, Esmeralda and I were both, we both were at the same event that became a world, a Guinness World Record, and that was most people wearing Groucho glasses, because we were at an outdoor screening in Grant Park of Duck Soup, and they wanted to break the world record by having the most people in Groucho glasses in one place.
And then Dan had one as well with
a hacky sack.
Your fellow, yeah, world record holder.
It was at St. Patrick High School. In high school, they broke the record for like longest hacky sack line or something. So
circle or something. Yeah,
the Guinness Book of World Records debuted today on this date.
Oh, okay.
So we're going to talk about that a little bit later on, and some of the most insane world records ever attempted, because there's a lot of really weird stuff in the Guinness World Book of Records.
It's always fun to just go through it, you know, on the website or their books. Yeah. It's always fun because each page has something cool.
There used to be I used to love that. I used to love that, like, world's longest nails. They would have, like, a woman who's got, like, nails that are, like, 4 feet long.
Hasn't cut her hair in 40 years, and she's got a trail going out the front door. Yeah.
Exactly. I always like when they put the world's tallest man next to the world's shortest man.
Yeah.
Those are always, I just like the difference that they do. But yeah, there was always like the weird Ripley's Believe It or Not. That's different than the Guinness World Record.
I have a story about Ripley's Believe It or Not. If it ever comes up, I'd love to share it.
Oh, okay.
It's crazy.
Oh, does it involve
Ripley's Believe It or Not?
Oh, all right.
I know someone that was on the show.
You know someone that was on the TV show?
Yeah, as a guest.
As a weird guest?
Yeah.
Something that you wouldn't believe?
Yeah, you wouldn't believe it.
Oh, okay. We'll have to hear about that sometime. There used to be a Ripley's Believe It or Not wax museum.
Yeah.
In Old Town on Wells near North Avenue. And I used to love that place. It was the weirdest. It was a Ripley's Believe It or Not wax museum. And they had the dude with a horn in his head. I just remember that was one of the wax figures, was a guy who had a horn. And that used to freak me out when I was a kid. We'd walk past the museum of the Ripley's Believe It or Not museum, and you'd see the dude with the horn. And I would immediately go, okay, that's just, I don't believe that. Now, you know who hosts Ripley's Believe It or Not right now? The current incarnation of Ripley's Believe It or Not? Bruce Campbell. Ash Williams himself hosts Ripley's Believe It or Not. I think he's the perfect guy to host that show. Used to be, what was it, Jack Palance? Right?
I don't remember.
Believe It or Not. I'm pretty sure it was Jack Palance.
It used to be literally, I mean, it was a show that was really big back when I was a kid growing up, and we watched it. And
yeah.
Wasn't it like a nightly show or a weekly? Was it weekly?
I don't know if it was. I think it was.
I grew up in California. I know it was on TV there. We watched it a lot.
No, we watched it too.
Okay.
I watched it too. I think it was weekly.
Yeah.
I think it was weekly. I know it was syndicated. And
it was a big show.
It was a big show. Yeah, we watched it. I loved it. And I used to have all the books, too. I had all the Ripley's Believe It or Not books, the picture books and all that stuff. So they get a little bit weirder than Guinness. There are some strange world records in the Guinness book. Some very strange ones and some crazy ones. But Ripley's Believe It or Not got real weird. That there is often some very, very strange stuff.
Did you ever hear the one about the guy that claimed he bought the ghost of Howard Hughes?
Bought the ghost of Howard Hughes?
Right.
No, I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, that guy lived with us.
What?
He was a friend of my dad's in California, and he lived with us. He was on Ripley's.
So that's the guy you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Craziness.
That sounds a little wacky. We've got to get more details on that a little bit later on. But we got a break now. And it's Vic in the Newsroom. Tom is producing. I'm your host. Paul Scheer, comedian, actor, writer, podcaster, is going to join us. Very funny guy. And we're looking forward to talking to him. And that'll happen right after this break. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the WGN Skyline studio, here until 5 a.m. 2 for Tuesday, get your requests in now. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about some sports mascots We've got some Guinness Book of World Records to jump into, and insufferable movie characters, of which there are plenty. So that's all coming up right here on the show. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And I am really, really thrilled to welcome to the show somebody who is just so talented and really, really funny. He's a comedian, a writer, a podcaster, Paul Scheer, who you can hear on his podcast. He's got Unspooled and another one, a great podcast called How Did This Get Made? You remember from the show The League, and he's currently on Black Monday, which is on Showtime and is a really terrific show. And I'm just thrilled to have the guy on the show. Paul, welcome to the show.
I am so excited to be here. How are you?
I'm good, good, good. I'm a big fan, man. Have been a big fan for many years. So
you're awesome to say that. I was excited to hear the Death from Above theme coming in on the bumper. That's from Human Giant.
Exactly, man. Human Giant.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about, let's just jump right into Human Giant, man. How did that come about? And, you know, my producer, Tom, massive fan. It was a life changer for him, and I'm also a big fan. Talk about Human Giant a little bit.
Yeah, so Human Giant was a sketch show that I did with Aziz Ansari and Rob Hubel. It was directed by Jason Wolner, and we've all kind of came together from very different backgrounds and created a sketch show that had no business being on MTV at the time it was. I mean, we were on MTV when it was like The Hills and Us. You know, we did not fit in at all.
Right.
But in a great kind of way, we flew so far under the radar that we got to do whatever we wanted to do, because as we would pitch them sketches, they were so not used to comedy on their network. They would be like, you know, on this week, Spencer Pratt's upset because Heidi went out to a bar. And we're like, this week, we have a cop in a hot air balloon doing a high-speed chase from a bank robbery. And they're like, I don't know what to make of that. So, yeah, go make your thing. Go make your child actor agent. Like, we don't care. So we got really lucky, and they supported us really great. And, you know, we got one of, I think, the coolest opportunities ever on MTV, which is we got to take over the network for 24 hours straight. They gave us the TRL studio live for 24 hours, and they didn't give us any restrictions. We literally brought in bands. We played music on MTV, and at that point, that was unheard of.
Right.
Insane bands,
right.
Insane bands like Mastodon, just like a hardcore metal band, you know, and they're used to like Hillary Duff coming through there.
Right.
And we were bringing on cast members from The Wire because we love The Wire. But like, this is, we were so anti-MTV and on MTV. It was one of the best experiences. And we did that show for 2 years. And then Aziz had gotten Parks and Recreation, and the thought was that we couldn't really do the show the way we wanted to do it. So they did offer us a third season, but we said no because we wanted to retain our integrity. And
right.
I think probably for the best. I feel like 2 seasons for a sketch show is kind of a great place to be. Two,
yeah.
3 seasons is, you know, get out while the getting's good.
Yeah, yeah. And it was such a great show and such a crazy show. But I do want to mention this. I mean, one of the main reasons why you're on is because you're coming to town next Saturday.
We're playing the State Theater, which is amazing. As a fan of Chicago, I'm excited to be in that. Like, that theater is beautiful.
Yeah.
It's amazing, and I can't believe we sold out our first show there. And I think we're pretty much on our way to sell out our second show there, too.
Yeah, the Chicago Theater is a beautiful, beautiful place. And it's Saturday, September 7th. How Did This Get Made? Live. The 7:30 show is going to feature the Adventures of Pinocchio. And the 10 p.m. show
with JTT, Jonathan Taylor Thomas.
That's right.
Presenting as Pinocchio, classic tale.
And then Space Jam at 10.
Yeah, and we're bringing it home. We figured, you know, we're in Chicago. We got to salute Michael Jordan. So we're gonna try to dive into Space Jam and see if it's as good as people remember, if it's just childhood nostalgia.
Yeah, well, you're going to be disappointed, Paul, when you watch it again.
I know.
How did this get made? By the way, it's just hilarious. You know.
Oh, thank you.
Your wife is on it, June Diane Raphael, and Jason Mantzoukas, who is just so mm-hmm. hilarious. How did that all begin?
You know, Jason, June, and I have been friends forever. We all were at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in New York, just good friends. And one night, June and I have gone to see a movie, Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps, and a classic movie, really a necessary sequel. I know they talk a lot about, you know, sequels that aren't necessary. That one really needed to happen. And we find out what happened to Gordon Gekko. And we sat down at this party and we're just having a drink. And June and I started telling Jason about it. It was so bizarre. The movie is so big. Like, I think it like essentially ends in like a dance sequence with balloons. And as we're telling Jason the thing about the movie, he goes, "Oh, that's a podcast." And I go, "What do you mean?" He goes, "That's a podcast." And I go, "Well, let's do a podcast, and you got to be on it too." And he's like, "All right." And then that was it. And you know, this is back in the day when you would have to take 10 minutes to explain what a podcast
was
to people to get them to come on your show. You know, there's like, now we live in a world where everyone has a podcast. Almost if you don't have a podcast, what's wrong with you? It's not even like, why aren't you on Twitter? It's like, why don't you have a podcast? Where's your merch?
Yeah. So was it that, then you just decided that you were going to, now you do all kinds of movies, not just terrible ones, but all kinds.
Well, I mean, here's the idea. Like, how did this get made is trying to capture that feeling that you get when you see a movie that you just need to talk about with your friends. It's like, we could do this show for movies like There Will Be Blood. It just would not be funny. It would be like, oh my God, I love that scene. Oh my God, the acting is so great.
Yeah.
What we try to do is talk about the movies that need to be talked about, like Fast and Furious or Hobbs and Shaw.
Yeah.
Like, those movies are on the good side of the spectrum. And then for the most part, they're bad movies, but they're kind of like weird ones too. You know, we just had a very controversial episode about a movie called Drop Dead Fred, a Phoebe Cates movie.
Yep.
Where her invisible friend comes back to kind of make her life better by making it worse.
By the way, Paul, our morning guy here who does Morning Drive, Steve Cochran, he's in Drop Dead Fred.
He is. Who does he play?
He plays a waiter. He's got two scenes, and he plays. A
oh my gosh! One of the best scenes in the movie, whole pasta scene. Yeah. Well, so we got into a big fight on the show about, are you Team Fred or are you Team Sanity? Do you want, like, we couldn't believe if like Fred was a driving force for good or evil, and so it became like a real big argument on the show, and we found that so many young people who grew up in the 90s like grew up loving this movie, and it was like the biggest sacrilege we've ever made by kind of going against it. It was a very fun split. So yeah, the shows are fun, and you know what we want to do is always make it a fun experience. There's so many bad movies out there that aren't fun to watch.
Yeah,
we try to find the movies that are fun. And what I love about the live shows is that we're in a room of a couple thousand people who've all watched the same thing, and there's an energy to that. It's like every show is completely unique. Like, we don't travel around doing Space Jam all over the country. One show, one night only. And, you know, so you can come to two shows back to back and you have two completely different shows.
Right.
And there's just a fun thing to that energy. People come in costume. They sing songs. It's a real, like, I love our live shows. And we always cut about 20 to 30 minutes out. So there's stuff that no one will ever hear because we kind of talk, talk smack, and we don't want to necessarily put that on the podcast all the time.
I gotcha. Well, it's Saturday, September 7th at the Chicago Theater, 7:30 and 10 p.m. How Did This Get Made Live? Can I suggest a movie, Paul, for you guys to watch?
Please.
It's this film. It's very, very, very difficult to find. You'd have to like really look for it, but it's called Fever Pitch, and it's not the one with Jimmy Fallon.
Not the Jimmy Fallon, Drew Barrymore.
Nope. And it's called Fever Pitch. It's from 1985. It's with Ryan O'Neal, and directed by Richard Brooks, who actually was a really good filmmaker. But this is, without question, the worst movie I've ever seen in my life, and one of the most entertaining films I've ever seen. Ryan O'Neal plays Steve Taggart. He is a reporter who infiltrates the world of gambling in Las Vegas.
Okay.
It's got to be seen to be believed, Paul. It's called Fever Pitch. It's very difficult to find. I think you might have to find it on VHS if you're going to find it at all. But it is.
Well, you know, the internet has an amazing way of turning things up. You know, things come out. We find things. We can get things. All right, this is great. This is really good to know.
Yeah, Fever Pitch with Ryan O'Neal from 1985. Trust me on this, Paul. It will change your life. Yeah. As a fan,
high praise. Yeah. All right, I'm excited.
So how often do you guys record the podcast?
Well, we have been on tour. We release a brand new episode every other week, and in between those weeks, we do these mini episodes where we kind of interact with all the listeners of the show. We just came back from a 12 city tour, and now we're on our second leg of the tour. Chicago kicks us off, and then we travel around the country a little bit more on the weekends while June, my wife, is doing her book tour. She just wrote a book called Represent, A Woman's Guide to Running for Office. So she's kind of running her book tour with our How Did This Get Made tour.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Hey, Paul, hang on, okay?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. Paul Shearer is with us, a writer, comedian, actor, podcaster, funny guy in general. Been in a ton of great stuff. We're going to come back and talk more. Again, How Did This Get Made? Live, Saturday, September 7th at the Chicago Theater. We'll have a link on our Facebook page for you guys to check that out. All right, we'll take a quick break, and we'll come back after this on WGN. All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It's Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday. Get your requests in now, 312-981-7200. Very excited to have on the show right now with us Paul Shearer, who you know from so many things, including Showtime's Black Monday. He was on The League. You saw him in Veep. He's got a couple of podcasts, one of which is called How Did This Get Made? And that's going to be the live podcast on Saturday night, September 7th at the Chicago Theater. Paul, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
All right. So I want to talk a little bit about, you started out. Now, when you were growing up, did you always want to get into comedy? Was that something that you were interested in?
Yeah, you know, comedy always is something that I loved. My dad was kind of my gateway to good comedy. He would tape things for me and like let me watch them in the morning, like SNL. I couldn't stay up late to watch it, so he would tape Saturday Night Live and we'd watch it together on Sunday mornings. He'd also do this thing, which I still think is crazy to this day, but there'd be great comedy movies like Beverly Hills Cop or even like a movie called Armed and Dangerous with John Candy and Gene Levy.
And he would
cut out the nudity and then let me watch the movies without the nudity, so I'd get to see like R-rated movies with no nudity. So that was like, he was always like helping me get to comedy. And one night I was out and I saw this like improv group, and I never knew what improv was, which is kind of like what Whose Line Is Anyway is. And I just fell in love with it. And then many years, of course, you guys are in Chicago. I don't have to explain improv.
Yeah.
And then I found the Upright Citizens Brigade many years later and started taking classes with them. Upright Citizens Brigade obviously came out of Chicago. Amy Poehler, Matt Besser, Matt Walsh, and Ian Roberts. And that kind of just changed my whole life. And I got into it like that.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that your dad, guided you through comedy. I'll never forget this as long as I live. I was a little kid, about 10 years old, and I was watching Welcome Back, Kotter. Like 10 or 11 years old, something like that, 9, 10. And I was laughing my ass off. And my father was sitting on the couch, disgusted. Like, he was just looking at me like, and he was disgusted. So he's like, listen, Sunday night at 10:30, I'm going to show you something. Because this is crap. What you're watching is crap. My dad was like so angry. He was angry with me. And then like Sunday night at 10:30, we put on PBS and there was Python. My dad turned me on to Python. And from that moment, it all changed. And so I thank my dad for that moment.
That's what dads are good for. I mean, it was just like, they can show you good comedy.
Yeah. Absolutely. So let's talk about some of the stuff that you've done in the past. I want to mention, I used to love the show Best Week Ever on VH1.
Yeah.
How much fun was that?
Well, look, so Best Week Ever was one of those shows where people like you will be like, I love Best Week Ever. And then I would say about 50% of people come up to me and go, you're great on I Love the 80s. And I take a certain bit of umbrage to that, because I have pride in Best Week Ever, because Best Week Ever wasn't about retro stuff. There was I Love the 80s, I Love the 70s, I Love the 90s.
Yeah.
We were doing it every week, and it was like kind of like a pop culture Cliff Notes daily show. We would just like riff on the topics of the week, and it was so much fun because, you know, there'd be breaking news. I remember our first episode, and this is how old it was, but Ben Affleck and J-Lo broke up, and they like called us like, guys, you got to get in here immediately. We got to record we got to get on here. We got to have a thing. You know, we recorded it like at 5 o'clock, and it got out there for the 11 o'clock. It's just like, it was just a fun clubhouse environment. And that was a show that we had people like John Mulaney and Paul F. Tompkins, and, you know, just so many great people came through Best Week Ever. It was one of the best gigs because it was just ranting about pop culture. It gave me my love for The Bachelor. It gave me, my love for The OC. Just like great, you always felt up to date.
Yeah, it was so entertaining and so much fun to watch you guys. And I mean, this show that I do is all about pop culture, Paul, and it's all about ruminating on it. And
I can't wait to hear about the annoying movie characters. We should put Fred on that list from Drop
Dead Fred. Yeah, he was annoying, but man, you got to love, rest in peace, Rick Mayall. He was the man.
Rick Mayall, young ones.
Yeah.
I take nothing away. Like, I'm just saying Fred as a character.
Yeah,
Rick Mayall
absolutely.
As an actor, Rick Mayall as a comedian.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, absolutely.
That performance, probably okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Listen, how hardcore are the fans of the league? Are those probably the most intense people that you come across? Because that show has some very, very, very passionate following.
Yeah, you're right. Like, I mean, look, the league fans are passionate. They want us to come back. We have another show that we left. We have a history of leaving my shows before they get too stale. NTSF, Human Giant, this. I kind of like that. But, we did that show for 7 years. And people, we're part of, I think, people's fantasy life. And you notice it at peak times during the year. Right now, fantasy football drafting has begun.
Yep.
And the tweets have kind of started up, and you bump into people, and I will forever be known as Andre to a large group of people, and I don't mind that, but it was a super fun show.
Yeah.
Jason, Nick Kroll and I are good friends, so we often hang out. So when people see the three of us out, their minds are sometimes blown. They don't understand. And, Jason Manzuka is one of the best, hilarious guy, but so not like Rafi that it's, I think, upsetting to people that he is not like going like, murder people.
Yeah.
He's not yelling and having a knife out in the middle of the bar.
It's got to be pretty funny to just like to have you three guys walk in and people just go, oh, like look over.
Yeah, I know. And obviously we're not even thinking about it because we were friends before the show. We were friends after the show.
Yeah.
So it's like, we're just going to see, literally going to see a movie. And then we're like, oh, right. Okay. Yeah. This is the thing.
Hey, you mentioned Nick Kroll, and I know that you appeared on it. I can't even explain how much I love Big Mouth.
Such a great show.
It is so good. And you appeared on it.
Yes. I have a reoccurring part on that. I am the character that Jason Manzoukas plays. I am one of his brothers. Me and Mark Duplass.
Right.
So another little bit of a league connection there, yeah.
Right. No, it's such a great show, man. I enjoy the hell out of it. It's just so
such
great.
A funny show, and it just keeps on getting better and better and better.
Hey, what was it like to work on Veep? It just ended. One of the best comedies ever. And it had to be a joy to work on that show.
Absolutely. I mean, so, we were talking about The League a little while ago, and that was created by Jeff Schaefer, who was a part of this brain trust that ran Seinfeld and Curb called Berg Schaefer Mandel. Jeff Schaefer of The League, Alec Berg went to do Silicon Valley, and now Barry and Dave Mandel does Veep. So I always think of them as like this big, giant comedy brain. So I've gotten to now work with two parts of that comedy brain. So there was an element of Veep that was very similar to The League, where it is just getting the best joke ever and trying to make every insult perfection, but also keep it loose and casual and not too written. And Dave Mandel is just a genius and just an amazing writer and just strives for perfection in every way. And they brought me onto that show, and I was such a fan, and Dave just said, look, I have a part for you. It doesn't have a name. It shoots tomorrow. We haven't written it. He's like, we haven't really written the scene. Can you just trust me and show up tomorrow? We'll figure it out on the day.
Yeah.
And I did, and I wound up being in every episode that season, got a SAG award for being on that show with them, and it was a tremendous experience. I mean, just a fun world. I was a fan, so just kind of geeking out about the whole thing. It was really great.
That must have been great. And I'll tell you something, that was one of the best series finales I've ever seen. The final episode.
I think people should take note of that. That was really a fantastic finale. I mean, it's so hard to stick the landing in comedy, you know, and they really, really, really did it.
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it. Okay, Paul, hang on a second, okay?
Yep.
Okay, there you go. Paul Scheer is with us, comedian, actor, writer, podcaster. You can see them live doing How Did This Get Made? Live Saturday, September 7th at the Chicago Theater, 7:30 and 10 p.m. And the podcast itself, How Did This Get Made, is just absolutely hilarious. We'll dive more into that and talk more with Paul right after we take this break on 720 WGN. People, help us understand what's the matter with you. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the WGN Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6. And there you go. It is Tuesday. Two for Tuesday. Get your requests in now. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. My guest right now is Paul Scheer, comedian, actor, writer, podcaster. You can follow him on Twitter, at Paul Scheer, S-C-H-E-E-R. And you can check out the podcast, How Did This Get Made, and the live podcast of How Did This Get Made at the Chicago Theater on Saturday, September 7th, 7:30 and 10 p.m. Paul, welcome back.
I'm excited to be here in the late night shift with you. This is pretty great. This is like I feel like this is my time. I like this late shift. I did radio in New York back in the day, K-Rock, and this night shift is really where it's at, I feel like.
You know, I've been doing the overnights for many, many years, Paul, and there's something special about the overnight shift, the late night shift. There's more of a deeper connection with the audience, I think. It's a much more intimate it's an intimate time, you know? And so, yeah, I've always loved the late night and the overnight shift.
I feel like people need it. Like, I feel like, you know, people who are listening to the radio, I don't know. I agree with you. I did what did we do? I feel like we did like 11 to 2 in New York. And it was such a great, you know, it's just sort of like you're just catching people at interesting times.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. It's a special time to be on the radio. All right, let's talk about Black Monday. That's got to be fun to do, right?
Black Monday, super fun show. If you haven't heard about it, it's Don Cheadle, Regina Hall, Andrew Rannells, and myself. It takes place in the 80s, and the first season opens with a body falling from a roof on the day that the stock market crashes.
Right.
And the whole first season is who fell, you know, and we have to figure out why they fell. And so it's a little bit of a mystery, but it's basically a comedy, a lot of cocaine, just total 80s excess. Don Cheadle's character drives a Lambo limo, which is all the, it looks like a Lambo, but it also is, but it's just a limo. So it's all the, I forget how they say it on the show, but yeah, it's like, it's just the most ridiculous car. So hard to get into, so uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean the whole show is about excess, and it's one of the things that I really love about it. It's so funny. You said cocaine. That's the most cocaine I've ever seen in any movie or television show ever.
Oh my gosh, it really is. I mean, they really go for it. I mean, I think all of our characters would have heart attacks. I think in the first scene, you know, we're all ordering from our drug salesman. And stuff. But yeah, it was a blast. A great show to do, and you have like these great people popping up in it, like people like Tim Heidecker from Tim and Eric, and just. It's just a fun way to do a show. You know, in a weird way, we've become so careful about what we can say and what we can do. And kind of going back to the 80s and kind of examining who we were in the 80s, you kind of see like, wow, we haven't made that much of a strive forward. But it allows us to actually play with a lot more stuff because it is a culture where we are a little bit more uncultured, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So that's been a blast.
Yeah, it's a terrific show, and it's been renewed for season 2. Congratulations on that. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Season 2 coming out this, I would imagine, this winter again. Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually go back to work in a couple days.
Very cool. So how did this get made? Who picks the movies? How do you guys decide on what movies?
We have an amazing producer. Her name is Avril Halley. She's somebody that I met many years ago when we first started doing the podcast. And she just gets the types of movies that we want to do on the show, which is they have to be interesting enough and fun enough to watch. And you know, and that's kind of the tricky thing, because people are like, this movie's so terrible, but it's not fun. And the way you were describing Fever Pitch, that seems like I have to see it.
Oh, yeah.
There's other movies where it's just an endurance test. Like, well, yeah, I did watch it. I was miserable. And we never want to make our audience feel like that.
Yeah.
So she does a great job of, like, cutting through and finding things. And I have to say, she's never been wrong. She's always spot on. And so she hosts a show called Movie Bitches and kind of is our gateway person. She does the first watch because it kind of gets hard for us to kind of pre-watch. And we don't want to give people the wrong one to watch. We don't want to risk it.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. Well, what have been some of your favorite podcasts and some of your favorite movies that you guys talked about?
Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, look, I mentioned Drop Dead Fred and Hobbs and Shaw. Those are our latest two. I honestly feel like if you've never listened to the show, those are a perfect two places to start, just because, I mean, look, Hobbs and Shaw, I can't talk enough about Fast and Furious, and Hobbs and Shaw, this is the Fast and Furious we were promised.
Right.
But over the course of the show, I mean, there's been some really, really fun ones. I think Sleepaway Camp, trying to break down this movie Sleepaway Camp, which is one of the classic, craziest horror films you'll ever see, is one of the most fun episodes. We are just simply confused. And still to this day, people try to write in and explain what they think is happening in the movie.
Yeah.
And no one can quite break down what the opening scene actually means.
Yeah, and that ending, you know, and the ending is unbelievable. The ending of that movie is just unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Absolutely insane.
Yeah.
You know, and there's been some really, just, you know, some really fun ones we've done. Like Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron came on the show recently, and they were our two guests, and they just were so funny. We did this movie with them. It was like it was Hello or Prom Night 2, Hello Mary Lou.
Oh God!
and great, super fun episode. Also, Seth Rogen has actually been on the show now a bunch of times. We also did a Van Helsing movie with him, which was really good. Hugh Jackman.
Yeah.
And then there's like some personal favorites of mine. Like when you go back in the catalog, you know, Face Off with Randall Park from Fresh Off the Boat. Great episode of just this, you know, that's a great movie. Well, thank God it got made. We love it.
Yeah.
But we need to be discussing it, you know?
Yeah. That sounds great. Now you mentioned Charlize Theron and Seth Rogen. You were in The Long Shot.
Yes, I was.
I really wish more people would have seen that movie. I think it's terrific.
I know. Well, you know, it's out on video now, or you can, or whatever you get now, whatever it is, streaming
right,
or,
right.
Yeah, it's you can watch it now. It's such a good movie. It just was in that weird zone where it came out literally the weekend after the Avengers, and the weekend it came out, and it's like a weird movie fact, 90% of the people who saw the movies that weekend went to see Avengers Endgame. 90%.
Wow.
So only 10% saw every other movie. So that movie just kind of got shafted. I think somebody in a studio system somewhere thought, hey, we'll counter program against the biggest movie of all time. It's like on the second weekend and no one bit. But now I feel like it's gotten this really amazing life on video or on streaming, because it's like it's 90% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's a great romantic comedy that actually has like really solid jokes. And my wife, June, who you know from Grace and Frankie in the podcast, she's in it. She just crushes that movie. She's so good.
Yeah, it's a really terrific. It's a really, really terrific movie. And I, you know, like I said, I wish more people had seen it. So you have another podcast with Amy Nicholson, and it's more of a serious.
That's right.
It's more of a serious movie podcast. Tell me a little bit about that one.
Yeah. Well, look, so I love movies, you know, and I think we share this idea that we both love pop culture and stuff. And I think what I realized was growing up, you know, I'm the age that I am. I've watched a lot of crap. I've watched a lot of great crap, but I've watched a lot of crap, and I haven't really ever gone back and watched some of the classics. And I was at, I can't even remember where it was. I feel like either somebody's house or just saw this poster of the AFI's top 100 movies. It was just like a list. And I was like just looking down and like doing a mental cross off. And I was like, wow, I don't think I've seen like over 40% of these movies.
Hmm.
Like, yes, there's Wizard of Oz and there's Star Wars. But, like, I had never really seen Lawrence of Arabia. I hadn't seen Citizen Kane, you know, and like, and it's, and those are the movies that I never feel like I want to watch. You know, it's like, oh, I want to sit down tonight and watch, you know, Bridge Over the River Kwai.
Right.
You know, it's like, not, that's not, a, that's not my MO. I'm like, let's see Shazam. Let me watch that.
Right.
So I thought it would be really interesting to pair up with a person I really admire. Her name is Amy Nicholson. She's a film critic, does stuff on NPR, writes for New York Times. She's just like, just a great, a great kind of film lover and critic, and sit down and kind of have this, you know, serious discussion, kind of look at these films on the top 100 list. Are they that good? Do they hold up? And how have they influenced the films that we see now? And it's been an amazing experiment, because if you love film and you love this, like I do, and certain actors, you start to like, my worldview is opening. I'm like, I can see how Raiders has so many direct correlations to Lawrence of Arabia. I can see character actors that I love from other movies that get their start and be young and, you know, just killing it, you know, whether it's like, oh my gosh, Robert Duvall in To Kill a Mockingbird, you know,
yeah.
And like really sitting down and watching it. And it's kind of like the movie, the podcast is kind of like a book club. It's like we give everybody a movie every week and then we go and watch it. And then Amy and I have a discussion and the discussion continues online. But it's kind of a fun way to educate yourself. And as opposed to How Did This Get Made, I think they're really fun watches. Like, and we get great people to come on the show. Like Spike Lee came on the show to talk about Do the Right Thing, which is amazing. And Peter Bogdanovich came on to talk about Last Picture Show, which is an amazing movie, which I never would have watched.
Yeah.
And Conan O'Brien came on to talk about his love of the Marx Brothers. And Cary Grant's daughter came on like to talk about her father. Like, we've gotten really lucky and gotten some amazing people to, you know, speak. Like this week, Tatiana Maslany from Orphan Black is talking about Network, because she's obviously in the Broadway version of Network.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, it's a really fun way to kind of experience and talk about classics in a way that's not too hoity-toity. I don't know anything about these movies. I just want to enjoy them and just kind of, you know, ask dumb questions. So I kind of bring the everyman point of view on it.
That's great. That's Unspooled, and the other one is How Did This Get Made? You know, it's funny, you mentioned Network, and every time somebody mentions Network, which is one of my favorite movies of all time, I always like to mention that when that film came out in 1976, it was nominated for several science fiction awards. And now it's a documentary. You know what I mean? That's how much everything has changed.
It's funny. I was saying to, you know, saying to Amy when we watch it, like, I think there's a part of that movie that loses its bite now in 2019.
Oh yeah,
because what they're hypothesizing is no longer heightened.
Yeah,
you know, and that's crazy.
Yeah,
like, and you have to, like, we're talking about that. Like, you have to look at it through the lens of when it came out and how smart it was. But like, now we are literally living it.
It's
bananas.
It's crazy.
Bananas movie. It actually changes the entire film
in a
weird way, because you know, it's fantastic.
Man, it's, you know, it's Paddy Chayefsky was way ahead of his time with that one, man.
Oh,
I mean,
just
an amazing film. Listen, Paul, what a great time I've had talking to you, man. I'm a big fan.
Well, thank you so much for spending the time with me.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. Have fun when you're in Chicago, September 7th at the Chicago Theater, 7:30 and 10 p.m. How Did This Get Made? Live, and check out the podcasts, Unspooled and How Did This Get Made, and look for Paul in Black Monday as it returns to Showtime.
Thank you.
Paul, that was a pleasure, man.
Have a great night.
Okay, make sure you get Fever Pitch. Look for Fever Pitch.
I'm gonna start looking for it right now.
Okay. All right, buddy. Take
care. I'll talk to you later.
All right, man. There you go. Paul Scheer, everybody. Really funny guy. Really talented dude. Lots of fun to talk to. That was great. All right, we'll take a break here for the news on 720 WGN.
A nightmare. Trunk locks stuck. Big dice on the mirror. Grill like a truck. Lifters kicking. Accelerator sticking. Something on my left front wheel keeps clicking. Picked up to girlies. Now we're 8 deep. Car's barely moving, but now we got heat.
Yeah. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. I'm your overnight dude, 1 to 5 a.m. every weekday morning here till 5. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. My main man, Steve Cochran, will have your morning drive at 6. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. 312-981-7200. Who requested that?
That was Mark the Breadman. Wanted to hear a little Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Yes. Yeah.
You know Dick what, was excited.
You know what? What song rules by Sir Mix-a-Lot? And I obviously yes. the obvious one is
Baby Got Back.
Baby Got Back, which is
no. There's a better one. I think I know what you're going to say.
No, which one?
I would say Buttermilk Biscuits.
Buttermilk Biscuits.
Oh,
no, that's
yeah.
not what I was going for. I was
oh,
going
so
for
good.
I was going for a song that's featured on the soundtrack of Trespass. Which is a Walter Hill film written by Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale. So that's like the best of all worlds right there. It's the Isis versus the Bills. That's how I look at it. The Isis versus the Bills, because it's William Sadler, Bill Paxton against Ice-T and Ice Cube. So it's the Isis versus the Bills. It's a great movie. Have you seen Trespass?
I have not. That sounds right up my alley.
It is a great movie. A great movie, like Walter Hill on, you know, firing on all cylinders. It's written by Zemeckis and Gale, man. I mean, it's a great film. I'm actually quoted on that video box. That was one. I think it's great. But anyway, the soundtrack rules, and obviously, Ice Cube and Ice-T are featured on the soundtrack. But the soundtrack has a great song by Sir Mix-a-Lot called "I Check My Bank." And we can't play it on the air because there's a language issue, but that is actually by far my favorite Sir Mix-a-Lot. I check my bank. Yeah, it's a jam.
Not only a great song, but a very good advice.
Yeah,
check your bank.
Check my bank. No, that song is great. But anyway, that movie. You should see that movie, man.
I'm loving everybody involved here.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Galen Zemeckis writing for Walter Hill.
Yeah, man,
that seems like an interesting mix.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's good. Geez, I should have brought my copy of that to have Zemeckis sign when I brought some stuff in. Because I did have him sign 1941, my mm-hmm. Blu-ray of 1941. He didn't direct that. But he wrote it. Yeah. But anyway, so I checked my bank.
Make sure to play it at my wedding.
Buttermilk Biscuits.
Buttermilk Biscuits. I do like this, maybe this piece of trivia that Vic Vaughn might be a big Sir Mix-a-Lot fan.
It seems like it. Seems like Vic Vaughn in the newsroom loves the old Sir Mix-a-Lot.
I know what to get him for Christmas.
And also, Sir Mix-a-Lot is truly one of the best MC names of all time.
Of course.
I love just Sir Mix-a-Lot.
Call 1-900-MIX-A-LOT.
It's the best. All right. Well, hi. So, you know, there are a lot of annoying and insufferable movie characters, and that's what we're going to talk about. Who are the first ones that pop into your mind? The most insufferable movie characters in film history. We want to hear from you. Talk or text. They just make you nuts. You can't stand them. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200, the most insufferable characters in film history. So they put together a list of 25 of them at yardbarker.com. We thought we'd talk about some of the most insufferable characters in movies. In this life, you'll meet all kinds of people. Some will be delightful. Some will be infuriating, and precious few will check that box marked insufferable. But you know the type. They may be friends, they may be co-workers, or they may be flesh and blood family. Given that art holds the mirror up to nature, you will definitely encounter these exhausting creatures in movies, and sometimes they'll sour your viewing experience. Other times, their insufferableness is the point of the portrayal. Which characters really drilled on our last nerves? Here we go. Did anything pop into your head immediately?
Ducky from Pretty in Pink. I can't take it. I love Molly Ringwald in that movie. I love Harry Dean Stanton in that movie. I love everybody else in that movie except for John Cryer as Ducky. Nothing against John Cryer. I think it's just the written character. I knew people like that in high school, and they were sad.
Well,
they were sad.
If you're going down the John Hughes lane, one of the most despicable characters in the history of movies is Ferris Bueller.
Yeah.
Absolutely insufferable.
I think Ducky's worse, but I get why
I can't
Ferris Bueller is
stand
bad.
That movie, and I hate that character. I hate that character. So yeah, I could see we could probably go through a good portion of the John Hughes movies and find characters that are pretty insufferable. I think we could probably find a few more in the John Hughes canon that would fit this. You know, I mean, even what's the idiot with the Red Wings jersey?
His idiot Cameron.
Cameron. Yeah.
I love Cameron. Yeah. He just has to deal with this total jerk for a best friend.
Yeah.
Who does all these terrible things under the guise of, Cameron, I'm just trying to get you to experience things, man. Yeah. And I definitely like Ferris Bueller more than you. You hate Ferris
Bueller.
Well, no,
everybody likes it more than I do.
Yeah.
I hate that movie. I hate every single frame. I hate everything about that movie. And especially the lead character. But in the Cameron, first of all, he's wearing a Red Wings jersey. I know it's Gordie Howe, but I don't care. It's a Red Wings jersey. You don't make a movie in Chicago and have a guy wear a Red Wings jersey.
I'll give you that. But I really like Cameron. Lord. I identify with Cameron.
Yeah.
I feel what he's going through, man.
Ugh. God.
And then Anthony Michael Hall in Weird Science. Both the dudes in Weird Science.
Yeah.
Because they're just gross.
Yeah, no, that movie is it's not good, except for Bill Paxton.
Because Bill Paxton is the man.
Incapable of being bad. Bill Paxton has never been not great in a movie. that's what I'm saying. He's got two lines in The Terminator, and he's awesome. Billy, Big Love. What are we talking about here? Big Love.
Jeez.
And he directed Frailty. He was great in that movie. Boy, that's a good movie.
Frailty's very good.
Yeah. What a gutsy movie to make as your directorial debut. You want to alienate an audience? Yeah. And my main man McConaughey. That was a good movie. And more people should have seen that movie. Well, it's not a crowd.
Yeah, Frailty is not like...
Not exactly a crowd.
Hey, man, it's a Saturday afternoon. You want to watch Frailty?
I love the portrayal of the children in that movie. I was worried for the youngest when I saw that movie. I was like, man, I hope this actor's okay. You know?
Oh, God.
Listen, if Linda Blair was fine when she was 12 and made The Exorcist, that's the standard by which you should measure child. But if you think a child has been traumatized by being in a movie, if Linda Blair is fine,
yeah,
yeah,
everyone else is probably okay.
Yeah, that's still I you know, The Exorcist, that thing still packs a wallop, man. I mean, really, my mom can't watch it.
The Exorcist?
She can't watch it.
Yeah, I get yelled at by my girlfriend for watching it because she grew up super duper Catholic.
Oh boy.
And so she legitimately has all these fears baked in. She knows they're on a certain level they're somewhat irrational, but like she's like she sees me wearing this shirt. I'm wearing this shirt with like kind of demons on it.
Yeah.
And she gets really upset. She's like, go sit in the other room. I won't have that.
It's funny, man, because you know, I'm Italian and Irish and not Catholic. I don't know how that happened.
You lucked out, man.
I don't know how that happened. But, you know, I get a lot of Catholic friends on both sides of the family. And they freaked out over that movie. And in reality, this is true. I don't know the exact stat, but people went back to church big time when that movie came out. Like, you know.
I'm sure the Pope was grinning. He's like, oh, look,
man,
the greatest advertisement we could get.
Yeah, people were freaking out, man. When that movie came out, I won't forget it, man. You know, when it came out, people were passing out in the theater. They had nurses and doctors on scene at theaters with smelling salts and stuff because people were freaking out. They were leaving the theater, running out of the theater. People were passing out.
There were people that thought that the film itself literally contained evil, like it was evil film and it had to be destroyed.
There were protests, then also there were obviously lines around the block. My parents waited 90 minutes to see that movie outside in the winter.
So they waited like an entire feature film just to go see a feature film.
To see The Exorcist. This was back when they had lines, you know, lines outside.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was at the Gateway Theater, which is now the Copernicus Center on Lawrence and Milwaukee, right there. And, but yeah, they waited for, you know, they waited almost 2 hours. And that was the norm when that movie first came out. People passing out, waiting 2 hours to see it. It was insane. I mean, it was the kind of pop, you know, the kind of pop culture that, I mean, the kind of the effect that it had on the zeitgeist of the moment in 1973, 74 was insane.
Imagine some kid from Chicago working in the mailroom at WGN TV goes on to become the guy who frightens America.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Good for Billy Friedkin.
Yeah. Good guy too, man. Hell of an interview.
Have you ever seen the interview between him and Nicholas Wending Refn?
Yes.
Where he laughs at him for calling Drive a masterpiece?
Yes.
That's when I really started to love him as a person.
No. He'll say whatever the hell he wants. He's William Friedkin.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I happen to be a big fan of Refn's work.
Same here.
I'm a huge fan. I think Drive's great. I love The Neon Demon. I love that movie. And people hate it. And I can understand why.
Yeah, he's frustrating for some people. I even liked Only God Forgives.
No, see, now that's where I gotta draw the line.
That's got some insufferable characters. Only God Forgives.
Absolutely. To get back to the conversation that we're having, insufferable characters in film history. 312-981-7200. Here's Ike on WGN. Go ahead, Ike.
Hey, Nick, how's it going with you, man?
All right.
Yeah, this is definitely the ideal annoying character, and he was part of a franchise, of course. Leo Getz, Joe Pesci, and Lethal Weapon.
Oh God! Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he's terrible, terrible. Yeah, it's a good one, Ike. Thanks, man.
No problem.
Mentioned in this article too.
Oh, you have to mention Leo Getz.
Oh my God!
Because he's designed to be annoying.
Yes,
and you have to give Pesci props for doing so well.
Yeah,
but horrible to watch.
No,
sometimes
no. And we've talked about this before. I don't like any of those movies. I don't like any of the Lethal Weapon movies. And especially as they went along.
Not even the one with Jet Li and Chris Rock.
I don't even remember.
I think it was a fourth one.
I don't even remember Jet Li being in a... I remember Chris Rock being in... I remember Joe Pesci was added in the... He was added in the second one.
Yeah.
Because he's not in the first one.
Yeah. He's like an informant.
Right. I just remember he did a drive-through bit. Like, they screw you at the drive-through. I just remember that's the only bit that I remember. But he's here. Here's what they say about Leo Getz in the Yard Barker. We're talking about the most insufferable, unlikable, annoying characters in film history. 312-981-7200. Joe Pesci's portrayal of irritating federal witness Leo Getz in 1989's Lethal Weapon 2 marked a comeback of sorts for the Jersey-born actor. At the time, it was fun to see the Raging Bull co-star work a comedic twist on his spark-plug gangster persona. After his Oscar-winning turn in Goodfellas, however, Pesci's pint-sized antics began to curdle into shtick. His two unnecessary encores as Leo in the third and fourth Lethal Weapon sequels represented the nadir of his film career. The character's sole function in both films is to work a new variation on how they screw you at the drive-through bit. Yeah. All right, let's take a break here. And we'll come back. We're talking about the most insufferable and annoying movie characters of all time. And we got some text coming in. We would love to hear from you on the phones or the texts at
312-981-7200.
This is not Buttermilk Biscuits, is it?
It is not.
Okay. What is it?
My Posse's on Broadway.
My Posse's on Broadway. Well, I check my bank. Welcome back, everybody. Two for Tuesday. Yeah, man, Two for Tuesday. Get your request in now. One artist, two songs. 312-981-7200. All right. We got a bunch of texts coming in. Phone lines are open. 312-981-7200. We're talking about the most insufferable and annoying characters in film history. Here's the first one that they mention in the article at Yard Barker. By the way, if you want to read this entire article, it's linked up on our Facebook page, which is another reason why you should follow us and like us on Facebook right now. It's Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Daniel LaRussa. Ralph Macchio's Daniel-san comes on a little strong in the first Karate Kid, but not to the extent that he deserves a series of ever-worsening whoopings by the Cobra Kai gang. He's far less likable in the sequel as a tag-along to Mr. Miyagi's Okinawa homecoming, but Machio, either out of boredom or contempt for the character made him a star, dials up the gregariousness to a suffocating degree in the third film. Man, I love the third Karate Kid. I love it. It's so ridiculous, completely ridiculous. And Thomas Ian Griffith as the bad guy is fantastic.
Those are the only two Karate Kids I own, are Karate Kid 1 and Karate Kid 3.
The second one is unwatchable.
Yeah.
Second one is unwatchable. First one is fine. It's the Karate Kid. It's fine.
Yeah.
Third one, vastly entertaining. Like, my buddy Scott and I saw it three times in the theater. Mostly because of Thomas Ian Griffith. He's so great and hilarious in the movie.
Got a 5.2 on the IMDb.
Oh, no, people hate it, and I can understand that. But let's see. He's wooing poor Robin Lively. It doesn't help that Robert Mark Kamen has written Daniel as an utter sap, but Machio's portrayal is so colossally unsympathetic that you're rooting for Thomas Ian Griffith's ponytailed heavy every step of the way. That's absolutely true.
You just want to see him beat the hell out of Daniel LaRusso.
There's a scene in the movie. What's the bad guy's name in the first one?
Oh, it's Johnny.
Not Johnny. The guy who runs Cobra Kai. Yeah, the sensei. Because he shows up in the third one. I'm trying to remember the actor's name, and I can't remember.
It's Kreese.
Yeah, but what's his name? The actor.
Martin Cove.
Martin Cove. Right. Yeah. Okay. So there's a scene in Karate Kid 3. Where, like, Thomas Ian Griffith has been pretending to like Danielson, and teach him things in his dojo, you know, and you know, show him the right way and everything. So Daniel thinks that this guy, Thomas Ian Griffith guy, is actually a good guy. But then he realizes that he's working with Martin Cove. There's a scene in the movie where he's in the dojo, in the bad guy's dojo, and Martin Cove comes out and, like, blindsides him. And he sees him, and he starts laughing. Like, Martin Cove starts maniacally laughing. And I don't remember the details, but suddenly a white paint gets dumped on both of them, gets dumped on Thomas Ian Griffith and Martin Cove. And I just remember... It's been a long time since I've seen it, and I've seen it a bunch of times, but like paint falls on them, like white paint falls on them. Martin Cove comes out of nowhere and freaks out Danielson as he's backing out, trying to get out of this dojo because he's freaking out. And they're laughing maniacally and covered in white paint. And that's the only thing, that's the one thing, and they're covered in white paint. One of my favorite images in film history.
Jeez.
It's such a stupid movie. 773 area code texts in. By the way, if you want to text or call, it's 312-981-7200. We're talking about the most insufferable and irritating characters in movies. 773 says Ferris Bueller. Another 773 says, I'm with you on Ferris Bueller. From a Star Wars lover, Jar Jar... Oh, yeah. Jar Jar Binks. You knew that one was going to come up.
You have to.
Yeah.
You have to.
William Atherton in everything, and he's so good at it. Well, William Atherton in the 80s... dominated the a-hole characters. And I always like to ask people, where is he the best a-hole? Is it Die Hard? Is it Die Hard 2? Is it Real Genius? Or is it Ghostbusters?
I think it's got to be between Die Hard 2, because he just ramps it up for Die Hard 2.
Yeah, and then he's stuck on the plane, too.
Yeah.
But have you seen Real Genius? Okay, he's really a... I mean, you know, he just cornered the market on jerks in the 80s and into the early 90s. I mean, come on, Die Hard? That's legendary jerk. Jar Jar Binks gets another mention here. Jar Jar Binks... And Paul Giamatti's character in Sideways sat through both Moe's movies wanting them they wanted them both to die. How could you say Paul Giamatti's character in Sideways? He's a flawed guy. I don't agree with that at all. And in fact, the Miles in Sideways, the character that Paul Giamatti plays, is the character that I have most identified with in any movie. So, being a huge Star Wars fan, Jar Jar is my top annoying movie character, Mark the Breadman says. Ace Ventura, most anything he does, there is funny and there is silly. Mary Tyler Moore in Ordinary People. I don't find her insufferable. She's got some serious issues. But I guess, you know, I mean, she doesn't treat her son with the respect and love that her son should be treated with. That's for sure. So, okay, we're going to break. And when we come back, we'll jump right back into this. We've got more of the most insufferable and unlikable characters in film history to talk about. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. The news is after this. The rain must be long, seems like I'm wasting my time. You show us home again, sipping my wine. And I'm gone, gone, gone. I don't care. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN 2 for Tuesday. You've been 2 for Tuesday. That's one artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. Who requested that?
That's coming to us from Sam, a little traffic.
Yes.
Rock and Roll Stew.
Yep. All right. There you go. We're back here. It's Nick DiGilio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 as your morning drive every weekday morning. Yeah. So we are now talking about some of the most insufferable and annoying characters in film history. There's an article here that we have linked up on our Facebook page, facebook.com/NickDShow. It's from yardbarker.com. They also now, we mentioned Jar Jar. Jar Jar Binks got some mentions here, which naturally is not a surprise at all. So we got some texts that have come in at 312-981-7200. Some phone lines are open if you want to jump in. But now we mentioned Jar Jar Binks, but this article mentions Anakin Skywalker. Let's give Jake Lloyd a break. George Lucas's writing of the little Anakin Skywalker in The Phantom Menace has all the depth and nuance of a second-tier Argang character. Lucas didn't completely screw up the future Darth Vader until Attack of the Clones, when teenage Annie, played by Hayden Christensen, is portrayed as a sullen, sand-loathing jackass. The prequel trilogy is far more fascinating than many people realize, but the tragic arc of its main character is undermined by this pouty characterization. Is sullen, sand-loathing jackass.
I mean, that's up there. That's right next to 24/7 clown show, Conor McGregor.
That's a great one right there. 24-hour clown show. They still go back to that one, man. Here's one, Scarlett O'Hara. Now, I know a lot of people might not, might maybe not agree with this, but Plantation Princess Scarlett O'Hara is as iconic as she is detestable. Vivien Leigh's performance is so brilliantly overheated that you can't help but give yourself over to the story. But dear God, does this spoiled daughter of the Confederacy challenge your sympathies with every step of the way. Unfortunately, the characters around her, save for Mammy, Pork, and Prissy, are just as rotten, yet none of them abuse the name Ashley with such ear-splitting abandon. All right. You want to jump in? It's 312-981-7200. Here's Paul on WGN. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Nick.
Hey.
I'm disputing that Ferris Bueller is such a bad character.
You're disputing that?
Yeah.
Why?
Because he saves his friend's life when he was drowning in the pool, for one.
Uh-huh.
And at the end of the show, when he wrecks the car, he claims he tried to take fault for the car. He offered to take the heat for it.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't be a
well,
bad person
none of that,
to do that.
None of that stuff, none of the stuff that you just talked about would ever happen if he didn't cause it to happen.
Yeah, but he wasn't so bad.
He's terrible, Paul. He's a despicable character. He's a spoiled, rotten North Shore little bastard who has everything handed to him, and he does horrible, despicable things to everyone in that movie. Is truly one of the most despicable characters in film history. So,
but Sloane's great.
I like her. I like the actress. Whatever happened to Mia Sara?
That's a very good question.
Besides Legend. Thank you, Paul. I disagree with you, but thank you. Yeah. Whatever happened to her?
Let's find out.
She was a pretty lady. But yeah. Boy, she's been in some bad movies. There are a couple of bad movies, though, because Legend is a terrible movie. What else was she in?
She's in Time Cop. Don't forget Time Cop.
She was Time Cop. That's right.
She got a special thanks in the Happy Time Murders.
Why?
I'm trying to find out.
What, did you see that movie, by the way?
I did, and I really wish I hadn't.
It's horrible.
It's one of the most insufferable movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody in it is bad. All the jokes are juvenile, and it really is not funny in pretty much every way possible. I would have rather just gone and seen Avenue Q.
Well,
which at least has a heart.
The other thing, I mean, it was absolutely terrible. I mean, just like really, really terrible. There was not one laugh in that movie. And like the idea was like, wait a second, you know, hold on a second. You know, Trey Parker did this already, you know?
Yeah, Team America.
Yeah, which is brilliant. I always say Trey Parker and kind of, because I think Matt Stone is the weak link of the two, because Trey Parker writes and directs every episode of South Park. He writes all the music. I think he's the genius, and Matt Stone was there going, yeah, I'll hang out with you. That's kind of the way I look at that partnership. It's Trey Parker who I think is the main dude. He's like the genius of the two. That Happy Time Murders, my God. And she gets Mia Sara gets a spec. Why would she even want to be thanked?
Wow. I don't know. It's a very good question.
Jeez. All right, we're talking about the most insufferable characters in film history. Here's Mike on WGN. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. I'm glad you put me on the air. Nobody's mentioned it. I'm kind of surprised. The most rotten, foul, vicious, obscenity-spewing maniac ever. Dennis Hopper as Frank Booth in Blue Velvet.
Yeah, I don't know if he falls under insufferable or annoying, but he certainly is. He certainly. I don't think he's insufferable or annoying. I don't.
I think he's fun to watch.
I think he's fascinating, actually.
But he is despicable.
He is absolutely despicable. One of the worst human beings that's ever been portrayed in a movie ever. And he's great.
But there's an entire beer corporation that owes a lot to him.
Pabst.
You know? Pabst Blue Ribbon.
That's right. Heineken. Yeah. thank you, Mike. 301 area code says Hart Bochner's character in Die Hard. Oh yeah.
That's the really sleazy dude that does all the coke.
It's a Rolex. Hans Bubby.
Oh God. That Hans Bubby.
Bubby. He's great in that movie.
Yes. Insufferable, but great.
Oh yeah. It's a Rolex. you know he directed PCU, right?
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah.
No wonder.
Hart Bochner directed PCU. He's also a total bastard in Breaking Away. You ever see Breaking Away?
Oh, yeah.
That's a great movie.
Very, very good. And
that's in my five guy movies of all time list, Breaking Away. 815 area code, the mayor in Jaws and the father in The Graduate. Disgusting. Yeah, the mayor in Jaws, Murray Hamilton. he's got a really great jacket with all the anchors on it. He's got a good fashion sense. Good old Murray Hamilton in Jaws. One of my favorite posts I've ever seen was someone posted online that said, make sure you vote. It's important to vote. It's really important to vote because the mayor is still mayor in Jaws 2. So you need to vote. How is he still the mayor?
You know, how does the shark come back for revenge three movies later? It just, it's ineffable.
Jaws 3D. Wow, that was bad. 708 area code, Sharon Stone in Casino. I totally agree with that. Best part of Casino is Don Rickles. Best part.
Have you seen the footage of him yelling at Bobby De Niro?
Oh, yeah.
It's so funny.
Yeah. You know how he got the part in Casino?
How's that?
Don Rickles was at a party, you know, like in L.A. or something. And he had never met any of those guys before. It was because the first time he ever met these guys was like when he worked on Casino. Because who's going to, you know, put Don Rickles in a, you know,
a gangster movie?
No. But it's the best part of the movie. I'm not a big fan of Casino. The Casino is like Goodfellas light, and I wasn't crazy about it. But anyway, he was at a party. Don Rickles at this party, L.A. party. A bunch of people are there. And Martin Scorsese enters the room. And from across the room, Don Rickles goes, he looks over, he makes eye contact with Martin Scorsese. Scorsese walks in, makes eye contact with him from across the room, crowded room. He goes, Marty, when? And he cast him in Casino. That's how he got the part. Marty, when?
I mean, so that's pretty effective. What was his name? Mr. Warmth. Good old Mr. Warmth.
Mr. Warmth. You ever see the documentary about?
Yeah.
It's so good. John Landis directed it?
I really appreciated that they captured the fact that when he says Mr. Warmth, it's both sarcasm but also true. He truly loves people.
He was a lovely man.
He loved people so much that he wanted to make fun of them.
He was really close friends. Jimmy Kimmel was really close with him. You know, obviously it was kind of late in Don Rickles' career when they met, but they were really good friends. They went out to dinner all the time. They went over to each other's houses and all that stuff. And when Rickles died, Kimmel couldn't contain himself. Like he just started weeping, talking about how very great a man Don Rickles was. And he was also hilarious. You ever see Dirty Work?
Yeah, of course.
With the great Norm MacDonald. And
Artie Lang.
Yeah. Look at you, you gorilla. Because Don Rickles just one scene.
Yeah.
And it's really great. If you can hear, because Artie was on Stern, obviously, and he told the story about the one day that they had Don Rickles. Just the one day, just to shoot the scene. And the whole behind-the-scenes story about Rickles, you know.
It's great stuff.
Yeah. 630 area code. Hey, Nick, Nurse Ratched. Villain, yeah. See, I don't know if that's insufferable or annoying. She's mean and nasty, and she's Nurse Ratched.
Mm-hmm.
How about the Spice Girls in Spice World? Hey!
Leave them alone.
Leave the Spice Girls alone. I like Spice World.
It's a very strange movie.
I like it.
Very particular part of 90s culture.
I'll tell you another one that I like. I like Spice World, and I like Josie and the Pussycats.
Well, Josie and the Pussycats is an amazing satire.
I mean, I think that's a terrific movie.
It's so good.
Rachel Lee Cook, Tara Reid, and Rosario Dawson.
Rosario Dawson, yeah.
And Richard E. Grant is in both of them. The great Richard E. Grant is in both of those movies. Shia LaBeouf in Indiana Jones. Yeah.
Yeah, very insufferable.
And I like Shia LaBeouf. I'm a fan.
Big fan of LaBeouf.
I am. Ever since I saw him on that Project Greenlight. Way back when. What the hell was the name of that movie? It was the Battle for Something. It was the movie, the first time they did Project Greenlight. HBO did Project Greenlight. Shaker Heights, the Battle of Shaker Heights.
Yeah.
Ever since then, I've liked him. And we talked about the movie Holes.
Yeah, he's great in it.
Great in it.
Stanley Yelnats.
Yeah. Jack Black and I Still Know What You Did Last Summer. Jack Black was in that movie?
I only ever saw the first one.
I don't remember that. Okay. All right, we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll jump back into this. We are talking about insufferable and annoying film characters. Phone lines are open. Text lines are going. It's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Like a hurricane around your heart. When earth and sky are torn apart. He comes gathering up Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we are live here in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. Two for Tuesday. Yeah, man, two for Tuesday. One artist, two songs, 312-981-7200. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Okay, we are talking about some of the most insufferable and annoying characters in film history. There's a lot of them, and we want to hear from you. Either talk or text at 312-981-7200. Here's Elizabeth on WGN. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Nick. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
My nomination for the most insufferable character, and I would have drowned him, is Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone.
Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that movie either, Elizabeth.
Oh, yeah. You and I agree.
Okay, thanks, Elizabeth.
Good night.
Good night. Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone. Yeah, I'm not a fan.
It's like Die Hard for kids.
Not a fan of that movie at all. Yeah. So let's see here some more. Sam Witwicky. The hell is that?
Sam Witwicky, the central protagonist of the Transformers movies.
Oh, LaBeouf?
Yeah, LaBeouf.
Well, I don't even remember people in that movie.
It's mostly just horrible CGI machinations.
God, those movies are terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, really terrible. You know what? I didn't see Bumblebee.
I was supposed to actually be halfway decent.
No, it's supposed to be good. Yeah. It's supposed to be really good. You got one of my favorite young actresses in it, too, who I love. She was so great in Edge of 17.
Mm-hmm.
I love that movie. I adore that movie. And she's so good. Hailee Steinfeld is so good in it.
Well, when your first movie is True Grit,
yeah,
the remake, which was great, comes out of the gate.
Yeah.
But Edge of 17 is like...
It's phenomenal.
One of the great modern teen movies.
There's no question about it. There's no question about it. It's one of the best coming-of-age movies I've seen. And the stuff between her and Woody Harrelson in that movie is gold. Yeah, if you've not seen that movie, really, you should check it out. But Sam Witwicky? It was Steven Spielberg's brilliant idea that the story of the first Transformers movie should be about a boy and his first car. It sounds charming and sweet. No, not in the hands of mayhem merchant Michael Bay, who allowed Shia LaBeouf to no his way through three narratively incoherent films. Sam's constant state of distress is exhausting as the movies, particularly Revenge of the Fallen. I don't even know which one that is.
Number two.
Okay. I don't know. He's not entirely extraneous. The writers always ginned up some contrivance to make his character integral to the plot. But therein lies the problem. Nobody wanted to see a Transformers movie about a boy in his car. They wanted to see giant robots smack each other silly. As for a girl in her car, that turned out to be pretty spiffy in Bumblebee, which also happened to be the first Transformers movie that was not directed by Michael Bay. Okay, so, you know, we talked to Paul Scheer a little earlier, right? Next one in this article, Drop Dead Fred. Though 8 DeJong's black comedy is to some extent an admirably subversive studio film about the lasting effects of childhood emotional abuse, there's no getting around Rick Mayall's irritating portrayal of the imp, the titular imp. Whereas the late British comic was brilliantly abrasive as anarchist Rick and the young ones, he's completely unhinged as Phoebe Kate's imaginary friend who returned to help her cope with numerous adult crises. Drop Dead Fred was supposed to establish Mayall as a comedy superstar in the U.S., but it did the exact opposite. Um, 773 area code says, see Thomas Howell's character in Soul Man. How was that movie even made? How? Have you seen Soul Man?
Oh, I've seen Soul Man. What year was that? 80-something?
Mid-80s? 86, maybe?
That's, like, shocking that people could get away with that in the mid-80s.
Why was James Earl Jones in it? Or Ray Don Chong? Well, Ray Don Chong was dating C. Thomas at the time. But how did somebody go, yeah, that sounds like a good idea for a movie? 331 area code says Kate Capshaw's character in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom just so happens to be the next character on this list. Willie Scott. Indy! The good of Cape Capshaw's legendarily grating portrayal of Willie Scott is the most relentlessly entertaining Temple of Doom is that it evokes a glorious degree of exasperation from Harrison Ford. He's absolutely beside himself that he has to field complaints from a pampered showgirl while he's scrambling to save their skins. It's a hoary bit of cliffhanger business, but it brings out the most entertaining version of Indy. So for this reason alone, Willie is an effective character. That said, the harsh frequency of Capshaw's whine could cut through the door of a vault. Yeah, very. She's pretty annoying.
We're not sinking. We're crashing.
I love that movie though.
Oh, it's great.
I actually think Temple of Doom is the best of the four.
Yeah, there's four.
I always forget about the refrigerator one. Rupert Pupkin. Yeah. But that's the point of the movie, though. Jerry, let me show you a picture of my pride and joy. By the way, that's my dad's joke. Insufferable, pitiful, and ultimately dangerous. That's would-be comedian Rupert Pupkin in Martin Scorsese's masterful cringe fest, The King of Comedy. Robert De Niro is superb as a deluded loner skittering around the fringes of a world where he'll never find success. In many ways, his perpetual smile and cheery demeanor are even more menacing than Travis Bickle's vengeful screeds. But while it's a great performance, it ain't exactly a party to spend 109 minutes with Rupert in Rupert's company. It's skin-crawling stuff. Yeah, it's also great. The most uncomfortable, I mean, because it's a movie that people hate that movie. And when it came out, it was the follow-up to Raging Bull. And people didn't know what to make of it. They had no idea what to make of it. It's a great companion piece to Taxi Driver. It's a great companion piece. And I love it. I love King of Comedy. Not just because Jerry Lewis is in it, but it's a great film. But nobody knew what to make of that movie when it came out. Like, nobody. But the most uncomfortable, it's a very uncomfortable movie to watch all the way through, but the most uncomfortable scene is when he and Diane Abbott show up uninvited to Jerry Lewis's summer home, and he has to come off the golf course and confront them. Every single time I watch that movie, and I've seen King of Comedy many, 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 many times, that scene makes me nuts. A lot of it was improvised. The whole line that Jerry says, "So did Hitler," improvised. That whole scene, and it's just nonstop. De Niro is just relentless in that scene, and just how uncomfortable Diane Abbott is, even though she steals from Jerry, and him yelling at the Asian butler, standing out here for 5 minutes, open the door, and he's got the golf club with him the entire scene. That's such a great movie. But yeah, Rupert Pupkin, yes, insufferable.
Very insufferable.
Yeah, but awesome. All right, let's break here for the news. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And again, I wonder why this guy's in the Eagles. So,
you know, I keep hearing about the guy who's running against President Trump, Joe Walsh. And I keep thinking, oh, man, you know, he knows how to write a riff. Maybe he can write run a country, write a law.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here until 5. Who requested the Joe Walsh for Two for Tuesday?
It's coming to us from Steve, a little Life of Illusion.
There you go, Steve, Two for Tuesday. 312-981-7200. Getting back to this article about the most insufferable characters in film history. What do you guys think? 312-981-7200. Charlie Bedell is the character's name. And that's Nicolas Cage and Peggy Sue Got Married. Nicolas Cage is an actor who makes strong choices, very strong choices, strong as the comic book character that gave him his stage name in Francis Ford Coppola's nostalgic Peggy Sue Got Married. Cage plays crazy Charlie Bedell with a highly affected nasal draw and a desperate-to-be-loved energy that evidently repelled the film star Kathleen Turner. They did not quite get along when they were making the movie, and she hated the stuff that he was doing. He's such an overwhelming cad that you have trouble buying the couple's heartwarming reconciliation at the film's conclusion. You're just bummed that Peggy Sue stuck with this jerk. That's the thing about that. I actually really like that movie a lot. I like Peggy Sue Got Married quite a bit. I think it's pretty great. And I kind of like his performance. I can understand people being completely put off by it because it's really a weird performance, but it's Nicolas Cage. He does that kind of stuff. Kathleen Turner hated it. Coppola let Nicolas Cage get away with it. I'm not sure why, because they're related. I don't know. But it really put off a lot of people. But I still like that movie a lot. I still think it's really good. And I think Kathleen Turner's great in it. But I will agree that it's a weird performance. There's no question about it. I remember the first time I saw Peggy Sue Got Married. I was kind of like, what is he doing? Nobody really knew what Nicolas Cage was going for there. All right, let's see. Napoleon Dynamite. The popularity of this movie has always been baffling to me. I never understood why Napoleon Dynamite became such a big indie success and became so popular in the world of pop culture. I don't get it. Never liked the movie, never will. Find the character to be incredibly annoying. So I agree with Napoleon Dynamite being in this article. John Hader briefly inexplicably became a star on the strength of his deeply annoying portrayal of a slack-jawed dweeb named Napoleon Dynamite. Some audiences believe this act to be some kind of absurdist work of art, a kissing cousin of Bill Murray and Gilda Radner's nerd characters on Saturday Night Live. It's comedy. Your mileage may vary, but if Napoleon Dynamite is not for you, it is very much not for you, as they write. And I could not agree more. Could not agree more with that assessment. That movie makes me nuts. I remember when I saw it, I've only seen it the one time because I can't handle the character. I thought the movie was forced, and I just never understood the popularity of
what Napoleon Dynamite.
I hate it.
I love Napoleon Dynamite. I can watch it. Oh,
it's a terrible movie.
Like, what are you talking about?
It's a terrible movie.
What are you talking about?
With a main character that I would want to punch repeatedly in the face for 2 hours.
Do you drink skim milk because you think you're fat? You probably drink at least 2%, if not whole milk.
Yeah, I saw it one time and I wanted to rip my eyes out of my head.
That is a
terrible movie.
Oh, it makes me laugh every time.
God.
Oh God. I could quote it all day.
I hate it every day. Hate every frame of it. 706 area code says Ned Ryerson. Well, yeah.
By design.
Yeah.
By design.
But Tobo's great. But yeah, the character is insufferable. 704 area code, Dwight Yoakam in Sling Blade. He's a jerk. Is he insufferable? Annoying?
I don't know if he's insufferable or annoying.
He's definitely a jerk.
Yeah,
he's a jerk. There's no question about him.
But it's a very good performance.
It's a terrific performance.
It's a great performance.
Yeah. From Mr. B, how about Sam Lines? And that Bobcat guy like nails on a chalkboard. I'm assuming that he means Bobcat Goldthwait. Okay. I don't know what Sam Lines is. I don't know what that means, but Bobcat Goldthwait. I guess he must be talking about the Police Academy movies. By the way, Bobcat Goldthwait doesn't really talk like that. I think he's also a really great filmmaker now. Like a really great filmmaker. 708 area code says, my submission for an insufferable character would be, Jack Lemmon, Sheldon Shelley the Machine Levine in Glengarry Glen Ross. Lemmon played it masterfully as always, but the character is hard to take. Yeah. There aren't really a lot of likable characters in that play or that movie.
You call yourself a salesman?
Yeah. Yeah. The thing about that, I love that movie. Obviously, it's great. It's great. And just the cast. I mean, that cast is just insanely good. But yeah, I mean, there's not. I don't know if there are any likable characters in that movie. Like Arano is he's another one that's insufferable. The Alan Arkin character.
And the Sam in that text was supposed to be Sam Kinison.
Oh no!
Sam
Kinison. Don't be dissing on Sam Kinison. Sam Kinison was a genius, man. So the thing about Glengarry Glen Ross is it's my second favorite play of all time. My first being Angels in America, but. It's my second favorite play of all time. And the Alec Baldwin monologue was written for the movie. It's not in the play. So as a purist, when I watch the movie, I'm like, this does not need to be. It's awesome. And Baldwin delivers it beautifully. But because I love that play, I think it's a perfect play. Every time I watch the movie, I'm like, this is awesome. Doesn't need to be here. Does not need to be in this. It does not need to be in it because I think Glengarry Glen Ross is a kind of a perfect play. One of the best productions I've ever seen of Glengarry Glen Ross was at the Steppenwolf. I want to say it was probably 17, 18 years ago. It was directed by Amy Morton. Mike Nussbaum played Levine. Dave Pesquese played Roma. One of the best sets I've ever seen. The second act reveal of the... Because the first act and the first act of Glengarry Glen Ross in the play, they change it up in the movie. But the first act in the play takes place in the Chinese restaurant. It's scenes that takes place at different booths in the Chinese restaurant. So your first... You know, the first set that they had on stage at the Steppenwolf was just like booths from a Chinese restaurant. And then... For the second act reveal, because when the second act takes place in the office... The whole second act takes place in the office, which has been ransacked. As for people who know, someone broke into the office and stole the leads. They stole the leads? So the reveal of that set, I saw that production three times. The reveal of that set, every time I saw the set, the top of the second act, the reveal of the set got applause. Because the set was so amazing. Like and how they revealed it. They just revolved it, and all of a sudden you're in this... You're in this ransacked office. It was one of the best sets. It was a simple thing. It was just an office.
Sure.
But the way they unveiled it and the way they moved it, it was one of the best productions I've ever seen of that show. And David was great as Roma. He's great. Now you know the legendary story about opening night in 1983.
No.
Opened at the Goodman Theater here in Chicago. Montaigne played Roma. You know, all the other guys that you know from you know, Chicago Mammoth stuff, they were all in it.
The usual suspects.
Absolutely. And so they're in their first act, and there's a big monologue that Roma has. You've seen the movie.
Yes.
Yeah. Where he's cornering Jonathan Pryce, where Roma is cornering and gives him this huge monologue and eventually pulls out the pamphlet and wants to sell him some land. Okay? Opening night, Montaigne went up on his line. Like, his monologue. Blanked. Like, blanked on his monologue. Yes. On stage. And he's on, and William Peterson played played the customer.
Right.
So he's on stage with Bill Peterson, and he's trying to help him. Like, William Peterson is trying to help him, but he just goes completely blank. And that's the final scene of the first act. It's a very short first act. So he can't think of it. He's blanked. He's completely blanked. And this is opening night of this show. Everybody from around the country is there to see it. Roy Leonard was there. He told me he verifies this story. So he went backstage, like, afterwards, and was just beside himself. Like, I can't believe this just happened. It's opening night, one of the biggest, most important plays that I've ever been a part of. I've got the juiciest role in it. And I went up and completely didn't even do his monologue. Like, they had to, like, improvise some stuff, and they walked off stage, and that was it. So during the intermission, he's like throwing stuff around in the green room. He's just, you know, losing it.
Oh, yeah.
Lindsay Krause comes backstage. She was married to Mamet at that time. Lindsay Krause comes backstage, and she grabs Mantegna and shakes him and smacks him and shakes him and looks in his eye and says, "Don't worry about what just happened. Get out there and kick ass in the second act. You're a great actor. This is a great part, and you're going to be great." Lindsay Krause. And then he came out in the second act and nailed it, and then it got raves. But Lindsay Krause came back and had to smack him around and say, yeah.
Give him the old guy. Are you a man?
Yeah, it was. But it was. It was Lindsay Krause goes backstage, starts smacking around, you know, grabbing Joe Mantegna.
Joe Mantegna, wow.
And, but he went, and it's a long monologue. It's like a page and a half, 2 pages long.
I gotta say, that's the one thing I'm lucky never happened to me in my brief high school theater career, is that I never dropped a line.
I've gone up a few times,
yeah,
on stage.
There were times I was scared, but I got close when we did the Laramie Project.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple times because there's some long stuff in there, but
yeah,
no, I lucked out. I was mostly given physical roles.
My problem was when I was acting. I preferred directing. Directing is so much more fun for me, because I really like watching people give good performances and helping that out. But my problem is that the factory where I did most of my acting, almost all of my acting, I did work with a few other theater companies, but the bulk of it was with the factory. Factory did comedy, and I break like a child. On stage, I mean, I am such an easy break. I will laugh at the drop of a hat, because I'm a terrible actor. So all I do is just laugh. I can't tell you the number of times we did this play called Alive, and there is a scene where two guys are on the back porch drinking beer, and they start improvising. We started to let them improvise, and they would say different stuff. They would do this whole thing about playing Star Wars when they were kids, and you know. Then they were drunk, and they're on the back porch, and they're pretending to be like Yoda and all these other characters. And the guys, it was Steve Walker and Mike Beyer, Beaver, who would do this scene. And, you know, we would let them, like, improvise and screw around. And we would have to keep a straight face because we were on the couch. The lights were still, we were still kind of lit. But they were supposed to be on a back porch, so the main spot was on them, on the back porch. But we were still lit, and we were sitting on the couch, and we were supposed to be, like, frozen. Sitting on the couch every single night, you could see me just doubled over with laughter on the couch at everything they're doing every single night. And it was not one night where I didn't bust out laughing on that couch. And it became like a thing. It became like, how soon is it before Nick breaks when he's sitting on the couch?
People are sitting there with stopwatches.
Yeah. So people did see that show multiple times. A lot of people would come back and see it again. And every single time somebody would go, it only took you about 4 minutes to start laughing. Thanks. All right, we got a break here. Insufferable movie characters will continue. You know, it's funny that that this coincidentally is the second of the twofer for Joe Walsh, because I just now, that's from the Warriors, by the way. And it's 2 for Tuesday. You made 2 for Tuesday, and that's the second of the Joe Walsh twofer. But we were talking about insufferable and annoying characters in movies, and there are a lot here. If you want to jump in, we would love to hear from you at 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. It's funny because that In the City, the Joe Walsh song is used at the end during the end credits of The Warriors, which is a one of my favorite movies. But it also contains one of the most insufferable characters of all time. And that's David Patrick Kelly. David Patrick Kelly, who is the leader of the well, I can't even remember the name of the gang. The guys who frame the Warriors for shooting Cyrus. But he's like the leader of the gang. The Rogues is the name of the gang. But David Patrick Kelly is just such an annoying character in that movie. That I think it makes sense that we just played that because he is just there's a scene where he's making a phone call and they're at a newsstand and they're just taking like candy bars and stuff out of the newsstand, and he was just making a phone call to see, you know, what kind of progress they're making at trying to get the Warriors. And so the girl who's working in the newsstand goes, well, what about the money you owe? And he goes, for what? I just remember that he throws like a candy bar at her. For what? And then one of his lieutenants or whatever in the gang, these goofballs, goes, I'm just a little worried. And he goes, they're looking for the Warriors, remember? And then he like pushes the guy's head. That's an annoying character. So it just totally fits in this discussion because he's so annoying in that. You're looking for the Warriors, remember? But he did improvise that the whole Warriors come out to play with the bottles.
And it scares me. It freaks me out.
But yeah, I mean, he just picked up three bottles, you know, and started doing that. And Walter Hill's like, what the hell is this? And so that's like one of the legendary sort of moments in movies. And that was David Patrick Kelly came up with that.
I still want to hit Walter Hill though for what he did for the director's
cut. No! I don't even acknowledge that. That's the only copy you have?
That's the only copy I have.
No, come on now. You got to rectify that.
Well, I'll see if I can find it on DVD.
Oh,
it's
got to
be a pretty old version of the DVD.
Oh, I don't know. I've had it for a very long time, so I don't.
Because I think Walter Hill and whoever owns the rights for the distribution purposely just flooded the market with
you got to get the theatrical
cut. Well, yeah, because I want the transition with the trains. Those are the real transitions.
I mean, but yeah, no,
I've seen the original version, but this is the copy I have.
No, you got to get the original, man. The theatrical version. It can't be that difficult to find.
I'll see if I can. I mean, I wish I would have just included it. You know,
I've had a copy of it. I mean, I've had it for a long time. I mean, I've had my Warriors DVD for a long time, and yeah. I've watched it a lot. So, here's Big Ed. Hey, Ed, go ahead.
Howdy, Nick.
Yeah.
You guys already got Nurse Ratched, huh?
What?
I said you already got Nurse Ratched. That was
Ratched, yes.
Okay, I got another one. See if this qualifies.
All right.
Felix Unger, Oscar Madison.
Yeah, Felix Unger, I could see that. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's one of the things that happens in the course of that play and that movie is that Felix Unger just drives Oscar Madison nuts. Yeah. But I love Felix. He is a pain in the neck, and he is insufferable. I love the scene. I love that movie. That's one of my favorite movies. The Odd Couple is one of my favorite movies of all time. And I love the scene where they're in the... where they're in the restaurant, and he's clearing his sinuses because like the air conditioning screwed up his sinuses, so he's going nah, nah, nah. And Walter Math, I was like, what are you doing? Stop that. All right, how about this? This is kind of They include Janie Bailey. The most convincing argument for George Bailey jumping off the Bedford Falls Bridge resides at home This is kind of mean, man. While Frank Capra did just about everything right at just about every level with this Yuletide classic, he whiffed badly on the writing and casting of the children. These are, without a doubt, some of the most annoying Muppets to ever step in front of a camera. The most of the bunch is Janie, whose delivery of not a smitch of temperature just sends the cathartic finale careening into a ditch. Oh, man, come on. That's a little mean. How about Benjamin Braddock from The Graduate? Baby boomer hero Benjamin Braddock, played by Dustin Hoffman, is far more sympathetic in the first half of Mike Nichols' landmark film when he's lazing around his parents' pool or engaging in a meaningless affair with Mrs. Robinson, played by Anne Bancroft. However, once he decides he has feelings for the Robinson's daughter, Elaine, played by Catherine Ross, Benjamin turns into a deeply creepy stalker who won't leave the poor girl alone until she believes his version of events with regards to her mother. Thematically, it all works as it's supposed to, but by the end of the film, on a personal level, we want nothing more to do with this privileged jerk. Okay. Oh, now we're back to John Hughes again. They have chosen John Bender. Judd Nelson's character in The Breakfast Club. John Hughes' teenage heroes, particularly the dudes, are all full of crap, but Judd Nelson's rebellious blowhard in The Breakfast Club is spilling over with the stuff. Every single character in the film is a self-pitying mess, but Bender, who's positioned as the film's truth-teller due to his wrong-side-of-the-tracks upbringing, is impossible to take. He's a bully, he browbeats and slut-shames Claire, yet he gets to claim fist-pumping victory for the group's climactic epiphany. I can see that. I can totally see that. But I still like the movie a lot. Okay, let's break because the news is coming up right after this.
Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea winds blowing. I still see her dark eyes glowing.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago. It's 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. Who requested Glenn Campbell.
Little cousin Campbell. Paul in Maryland. Galveston there.
All right. Cool. So we're going to talk a little bit more about the most insufferable and annoying characters in movies, and we want to hear from you. Talk or text at 312-981-7200. But also, in a little bit, we're going to be talking about the best pro sports mascot power rankings, because our good buddy Tommy Hawk was voted NHL Mascot of the Year. Blackhawks mascot Tommy Hawk, Mascot of the Year for the NHL. So... we're going to talk about mascots, which is one of my favorite things. I love mascots. If you're a regular listener to the show, you know they just crack me up. You ever see the Mascot Olympics? You ever watch the Mascot Olympics?
No.
I can't even explain to you how funny it is.
I mean, what kind of, they do javelin throws?
They do all kinds of goofy stuff. They ride tricycles and stuff like that. But yeah, mascots just crack me up. I don't know.
They're great.
Anybody in a goofy suit like that costume just makes me laugh. Every time they cut to a sideline, I just start laughing.
Now, is it the same for you? Do you like just as much when, like, where the Milwaukee Brewers play when they get in those suits and the sausage, the running sausages?
Oh man,
it's so funny. I'm starting to understand why you love mascots, because that's hilarious.
The sausage race is fantastic. Okay. And also in Washington, they do the president race, where they're also shaped like sausages for some reason. They're tall and skinny. But yeah, no, all of that stuff is classic. I thought you were going to talk about, because I know in Milwaukee they do the sausage race, which is legendary and awesome, but also Bernie the Brewer, fantastic mascot. And his wife, what's his wife's name?
He's married?
Yeah. Oh, man, I can't remember his wife's name, because it's Bernie the Brewer and his wife, and she begins with a B, too. Brenda Brewer, maybe? But Bonnie Brewer. But Bernie, every time Milwaukee hits a home run, every time the Brewers hit a home run, he goes down giant circular right. slide in center field.
That's right.
Yeah. And that cracks me up all the time. So, but we'll get to some mascots in a little bit. We'll jump back into that. And congratulations to Tommy Hawk. I love Tommy Hawk. He's one of my favorite mascots of all time.
That put that on his resume, right? That's a good one.
Oh yeah.
For his career.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. How about this one? Max from Space Camp. This was when Joaquin Phoenix was Leaf Phoenix. For the first part of his career, he was Leaf Phoenix. He was a lovable little rascal of the mid-80s, but there's nothing remotely adorable about him in Space Camp, where his incessant whining convinces a psychotic robot to turn a simulated shuttle launch into a perilously real one. Max turns out to be helpful at the retrieval of emergency oxygen tanks, but let's be real, the near tragedy never would have happened. It's all Max's fault. I've not seen that movie since it came out.
Never even heard of it.
Never heard of Space Camp?
Nope.
Kate Capshaw. It had horrible... The timing of the release of the movie was terrible.
Let me guess. It was right near Challenger?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it came out like right... I think it was right before the Challenger explosion. Like, it had just come out, and then the Challenger explosion happened, and then... Like, nobody went to see it. And they kind of, like, dropped it from theaters.
Hmm.
How about this one? Lester Burnham. Kevin Spacey in American Beauty. Possibly the most insufferable fictional character of the last 20 years, Lester Burnham is a frustrated suburban father who hates his job, he hates his wife, and he seems to be on the fence about his daughter. He reverts to his teen years by taking a job at a fast food joint, buying weed from a teenager next door, and most disturbingly fantasizing about his daughter's best friend. There's a sharply satirical component to Alan Ball's screenplay, but the film goes all gooey at the end. Mendez wants us to sympathize with Burnham, but aside from not having sex with a teenager, the character does nothing to earn it. Yeah, I can't stand that movie, American Beauty. I remember when I put in my top 10 list the year that movie came out, which was 99, right?
Yeah, 99, 20 years ago.
I remember when I put my top 10 list in to the webmaster to put up on our website. He sent me an email back because I sent him my top 10 list. He sent me an email back and he goes, "Did you make a mistake including American Pie? You meant American Beauty, right? On my top 10 list." And I went, "No, no, no, no. I meant American Pie, not American Beauty." Because I put American Pie on my top 10 list that year. Because I love that movie. And I hated American Beauty. How about this one? Leslie Zevo. Oh, God. Oh.
Who's that?
Oh, it's Robin Williams in Toys. Oh, God.
Yep. Nope.
Oh.
That's a big no.
That is a terrible movie. How about this? Trent. Vince Vaughn's this is in Swingers. Is essentially a horned up Jiminy Cricket to Jon Favreau's Mike. He wants his friend's happiness as long as he can, and he believes that he's steering him in the correct direction to Las Vegas, the Dresden, the Derby, and on and on. He's obnoxious, kind of racist, and treats women like dirt. He jumps up on the table at the 101 coffee shop and thinks it's cute. Trent, the guys you grow out of when you hit 30, hopefully. I like Swingers when they get back to L.A. All of the stuff in Vegas makes me nuts.
Yeah.
I hate all the stuff in Vegas.
I think Jon Favreau is a really cool guy. I think he's a really talented guy. I think Swingers is pretty bad. I think most of it is pretty insufferable. It's like, it's Entourage the movie before Entourage the movie came out.
I think the strongest stuff with Swingers, and I don't disagree wholeheartedly with that. I think the first like 20 minutes or half an hour, all the Vegas stuff, it sucks. It's annoying. It's everything that you're saying that the movie is. But once it kind of settles into L.A., and it's especially insightful about what working actors have to go through, or actors who are not working go through, that's really accurate and really good.
And Favreau is great in it.
He's terrific in it.
I couldn't get past Vince Vaughn.
Well,
and that's the point, I guess.
Yeah. But then you must have, like, if you didn't, like, then you must have hated Maid.
Yeah.
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 Maid is everything I hated about the first half hour of Swingers for 2 hours. So, here we go. Rose says Skyler White from Breaking Bad. 708, Clark Griswold or anything Chevy Chase. Well, I like Clark. I like Clark Griswold. I do, especially in the first movie, the first one in the Christmas one.
Yeah, I didn't get the vacation movies until fairly recently because I would just hate them. Like I didn't think they were funny.
The first one's hilarious, and I think Christmas Vacation is really funny too.
Christmas Vacation's funny.
The first one is really funny, really funny. About Doc says Nick, how about Crispin Glover as Lane and? In River's Edge. Oh, man. Oh, man. Yeah, that's in that, like, you know, when we were talking about Nicolas Cage making bold and weird choices in Peggy Sue Got Married, man, that performance in River's Edge. It's something, man.
It's original.
Yeah, I love that movie. I love that movie. I think Keanu's really good in it. Francis from Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Stripes, both annoying as hell. Well, there's two different Francises. Because the Francis in Stripes is, you call me Francis, and I'll kill you. You touch my stuff, and I'll kill you. Lighten up, Francis, which is one of the greatest lines ever. War notes. Lighten up, Francis. Now, Francis from Pee-wee's Big Adventure is absolutely insufferable. There's no question about it. But I like when spearmint or fruit, and he gives him the gum, and the gum has like black the
ink or something.
Yeah. Spearmint or fruit. That's another one of those movies, man. Pee-wee's Big Adventure. It's another one of those movies I could watch on an endless loop.
And either get it or you don't.
Oh, it's brilliant.
I loved it, but there are plenty of people out there that really have a beef with Pee-wee Herman. Don't get what the joy of that movie is.
And it's a great movie. And it's hilarious. Speck! That's his dog.
Who's Cowboy Curtis?
Lawrence Fishburne.
Yeah, Lawrence Fishburne. I still can't believe.
Cowboy Curtis?
Cowboy Curtis, Jombie the Genie.
Jombie and the King of Cartoons. You know who the King of Cartoons was?
Who's the King of Cartoons?
Blackula, William Marshall.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got the whole set at home.
Oh,
I have every episode of that show
on
DVD. And we used to, my friend Joe, hey, listen, what the hell happened after that first album? That Joe, every Saturday, he would tape it, and we would watch it at his house. All of us would watch it at his house every Saturday night. That's what we did. That was one of the greatest TV shows of all time. But it's Pee-wee's Playhouse, one of the greatest TV shows of all time. Pee-wee's Big Adventure, one of my favorites. Big Top Pee-wee, not so much. The Netflix one that came out a couple of years ago, good, not great. Better than Big Top Pee-wee. But nothing's going to top Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
No.
And Jan Hooks, God bless her soul, Jan Hooks as the tour guide at the Alamo. Oh, my God. Phil Hartman co-wrote that movie and was in it. Phil Hartman was on Playhouse, the original Playhouse, Pee-wee's Playhouse. Yeah. But Francis was annoying, I agree. Spearmint or fruit? Okay, we got a break here for some weather. We'll come back and we'll wrap up the conversation about annoying and insufferable characters, and then we're going to jump into the world of mascots here.
I am a lineman for the county.
and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another.
Such a great song. Great song. Wichita Lineman, Glenn Campbell, written by the great Jimmy Webb. One of the best songwriters ever. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the WGN Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It is Tuesday, 2 for Tuesday.
Yeah!
312-981-7200. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. WGN. All right, we're wrapping up the topic here, which is insufferable and annoying characters in movies. And here's Jimmy on WGN. Hi, Jimmy.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay, I got Jim Carrey in The Cable Guy or any movie he ever done.
You're not a Jim Carrey fan, huh?
No, every movie was the same.
Yeah. All right. Okay, Jim, thanks, man. Thanks, Jimmy.
Okay.
Okay. I love Jim Carrey. I loved him in Cable Guy. I thought Cable Guy was
great. Oh, Cable Guy's amazing.
Cable Guy's great.
When he's going to break down the door. Cable Goobla.
It's a great movie. And you know, of the stuff that Ben Stiller's directed, it's very close to being my favorite. I think my favorite Ben Stiller-directed movie is probably Tropic Thunder. But Cable Guy is massively underrated.
Is that a Judd Apatow script?
Apatow, yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Apatow produced it. I'm not sure if he's got a credit on the... I know it's an Apatow production. Man, did that thing tank when it came out. And everybody focused on how much money Jim Carrey was getting for that movie. That was the big focus. It wasn't how original and how dark and how twisted the movie was. Jack Black was in that. I don't remember him, and I still don't know what you did when you did the thing that you did last summer, or whatever the hell the name of that.
Yeah, it's an uncredited role in that one. He just appears. I guess it was written by Lou Holtz Jr. This was The Cable Guy, his one and only writing credit.
That's it? Ran him out of town, man.
Yeah.
No, because people hate that movie. People hate it. I think it's great. I think Cable Guy is great.
I think it's turned, you know, it's one of those things that people have reevaluated over the years and realized how much it affected a lot of comedy afterward, despite being a failure.
Yeah. God, that scene where they go to medieval times. Oh, my God.
He's screeching as he attacks him.
It's the best. It's the best. I also love Jeanine Garofalo in that scene, too.
Mm-hmm.
She's one of the wenches, as they say. And he's like, listen, can I have some silverware? And Jeanine Garofalo goes, in medieval times, there was no silverware. So here at medieval times, there is no silverware. And he goes, oh, okay. So they had Pepsi in medieval times? Give me a break, man. I got a lot of tables. No, that's a good movie. I'm a Jim Carrey. I'm a big Jim Carrey fan, man. Ace Ventura, I don't care.
When Nature Calls kills me.
Both of them are good.
So much.
The scene where he, and he's closing the screen door in the first movie still knocks me off my chair every time I was, Dumb and Dumber is great.
Climbing out of the rhino.
That's on a whole nother level, man.
My mom got really mad that I was watching that.
Well, it's a little much. It's very, it's just very weird, man. But and also in the second one, he gets two giant spears thrown into his into his legs.
Call him the White Devil.
He has to fight Tommy Davidson. That's so funny. Those are funny movies, man. I don't care. Then Jim Carrey, you know, can act.
I mean, Eternal Sunshine.
Eternal Sunshine. You see the Truman Show. I mean, you know,
Truman Show is a great movie.
It's a great movie. Didn't like that murder movie he made last year.
What was the murder movie?
I can't remember the hell the name was. Dark Crimes? Dark Crime?
I remember we did the number 23.
Terrible.
That's
a Joel Schumacher film.
Of course it is. Of course it is.
But no, so at Murder Village or whatever the hell it was, Dark Murders or Dark Village Crime or something, he was bearded and serious in it. That was terrible. It was. I watched it on the VOD.
Yeah, Dark Crimes.
Oh, it's terrible.
Dark Crimes. Wow.
Yeah. All right. We'll get back to some more characters that are annoying. We'll wrap it up here. Melanie Ralston. As long as she's lounging on Ordell Robbie on his couch smoking weed, Melanie's a pretty chill girl. However, bring her in the car and you've got trouble. Well, yeah, so much trouble De Niro kills her.
Just shoots her dead.
Gene Cabot. That's from Crash. Not the good one that David Cronenberg directed, the other one. Paul Haggis' low IQ Robert Altman homage. Hits its nadir with Sandra Bullock's Gene Cabot. She's the miserable, cartooniest, racist wife of District Attorney Brendan... God, I forgot Brendan Fraser was in that. And when she's carjacked, her bigotry goes into overdrive. Yeah.
What year was that? Was that 04 or 05?
Because
I think it beat, like, Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah, it was 05, because I had just started dating my second ex-wife. We had just started dating when that came out. Yeah, no, it won Best Picture, which was like, what? Lester. If it bends, it's funny. If it breaks, it's not funny. Woody Allen's best Bergman riff draws most of its mirth from Alan Alda's portrayal of an arrogant sitcom producer. Oh, that's Crimes and Misdemeanors, right?
I think so.
God, I hate that movie. But he's good in it. Alan Alda's good. That was when Alan Alda just started, everybody realized that he could really play jerks well. Because there was a period of time where he was, you know, always the nice guy, you know. He was Hawkeye. Mm-hmm. He directed movies and he was always kind of sweet and funny in them.
War is war and hell is hell.
But then he started playing jerks and he was really good at it.
He is.
Barry Judd. Oh, Barry. From High Fidelity.
He's not insufferable. I love him.
I have some issues with it personally. My guy who played Barry is better. In the stage version that we did, my guy Matt O'Neill is better than Jack Black. But I just don't. I don't think you know. I don't think the movie captured what the book really was. And they especially it was Lloyd Dobler gets a record store is what it should have been called. Lloyd Dobler gets a record store because Rob it, as far as I'm concerned, the way that we did Vinyl Shop. When we adapted it, Rob's an a-hole. The character is a jerk, and he should be portrayed as such. Not cute. Lloyd Dobler gets a record store. So,
but I do love Jack Black as Barry. I think his take is really funny.
Yeah, the best performance in that movie is the guy who plays Dick.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Todd Luiso. Best performance in the movie. I think he's by far he's the best thing in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
They put Will Hunting down here. How about them apples? And then Ruby Rod. What the hell is that? Oh God! It's Chris Tucker in the terrible Fifth Element. Luke Besson. Yeah. So yeah, that really truly that's a high note to end on this. Because that character in The Fifth Element, I can't even, if it's on TV, I'd put my foot through the screen. I can't even calculate just how insanely annoying he is in that movie. Oh. I find Chris Tucker annoying in a lot of stuff, but that one especially. Oh. All right. Well, there you go. We got a break here, and then we're going to celebrate Tommy Hawk's big win. After the news. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How's it going? And we are here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6. Tuesday morning, 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, 2 for Tuesday. We're back. Who requested the ELO?
Coming to us from our good pal, Ike.
Ike.
Don't bring me down.
ELO, right there. All right. Welcome back, everybody. So, I happen to have a weakness for, as we mentioned earlier, for mascots. They just crack me up. And some great news. One of my favorite mascots ever, Tommy Hawk. He's voted NHL Mascot of the Year.
Well deserved.
In a piece of news that should get Blackhawks fans even more pumped for the start of the NHL season, team mascot Tommy Hawk has been honored by his peers for his continued excellence. Tommy Hawk was voted NHL Mascot of the Year by the other mascots around the league. Oh, by his peers. The Tommy Hawk character was introduced to Blackhawks fans in the 2001-2002 season and has been steadily winning over fans ever since with his trademarks. His four-colored feathers, his Blackhawks uniform, minus the skates, complete with his custom Tommy jersey and his boisterous attitude. This has been quite a summer for Tommy Hawk, as he has also been inducted into the Mascot Hall of Fame earlier this offseason. Despite the obvious appeal of new kids on the block, like lovable Flyers mascot Gritty. Wait a minute. Gritty is being described as lovable?
What's there not to love?
He looks psychotic. Tommy Hawk was able to win over the hearts of the league's mascots, and with the Blackhawks bringing even more energy in what should be a bounce-back 2019-2020 season, expect Tommy Hawk to continue his reign as the NHL's premier mascot. He is the man. There's no question about it. So, sports mascots here. Pro sports mascots power rankings. You guys enjoy the mascots? Is there any mascots that you enjoy out there? 312-981-7200 if you want to jump in on this. I do not like the Cubs mascot. What's his name? Clark?
Clark. Well, especially after that whole thing on Comcast. Yeah. It's Comcast Sports Network.
Right. But no, I just don't. I'm not a fan of Clark. It's a mascot, so I like it. I can't dislike it. I like mascots that look weird. Like Big Red. I can't remember what college. He's a mascot for a college football team. Big Red.
That's for Kentucky University.
Yeah.
The Hilltoppers.
And he's just like a blob. He's just like a red. He's like a red blob.
Kind of looks like Q-Bert without a snout.
Yeah. Every time I think of Q-Bert, this is just ridiculous. Every time I think of Q-Bert, and I think of Q-Bert often. I'll never forget this. Do you remember when you were young when the Ang Lee Hulk came out?
Yeah, that came out in what, 2003? 2004?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I'm a fan of. I think the Ang Lee... By the way, his new movie looks just weird. Have you seen the trailer?
What's the new one?
It's two Will Smiths.
Oh, yeah. Gemini Man?
What the hell?
Wait, that's Ang Lee?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
The guy who brought us masterpieces like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and
Ice Storm,
and Brokeback Mountain, is doing a Will Smith movie.
You know what's really funny is that here's how they're advertising the movie. I've seen the trailer for it. I don't know what the hell Clive Owen is doing. Clive Owen is now doing stupid commercials now.
Yeah, he really just kind of fell off.
What? Why? He's great.
I don't know. He took bad roles, I think. After Children of Men, where did he go?
Well, no, come on, you Shoot 'Em Up.
Shoot 'Em Up is great, but that's a very niche audience.
And what was the one with the International? That was a good movie.
It was fine. Yeah. That's the one where he's like uncovering a conspiracy with like the banks and everything.
And there's
right?
there's that unbelievable shootout in the Guggenheim.
Yeah, it was cool.
That's a great movie. But anyway, Clive Owen is in the damn thing. He's like the scientist that makes two Will Smiths. One Will Smith is younger, so it's de-aged. Again, so you get more de-aging. So people are going to go nuts over that because they did it with The Irishman. So now it's Will Smith beating the hell out of Will Smith. Like I can't even handle one Will Smith in a movie. I can't stand one Will Smith. Now I got to have two. Anyway, here's how they're advertising it. This is I'm not making this up. In the trailer, it says from the visionary director of The Life of Pi. That's the movie they go to.
Yeah, I don't know about
why
that.
Didn't they go to Johnny Johnson's halftime walk or whatever the hell?
Oh, yeah, Billy...
Whatever the hell.
Billy Corgan?
Yeah, Billy Corgan, yeah. Billy Corgan's halftime walk.
Today is the greatest.
But anyway, so, yeah, how did we get on it? How did that happen? How did Ang Lee get in? What? I don't know how that happened. I don't know how we got there, but we got to get back to mascots.
Yeah, mascots.
All right. So here are the power rankings for mascots. The top 25. 25 is Raymond. You want to go with Raymond? And that's the Tampa Bay Rays mascot. And I'm looking at him right now. He's pretty good, man.
Pretty good mascot.
Yeah.
I'm surprised he's not a little bit higher, though, since everybody loves Raymond.
Oh, man. That didn't work. Oh, hold on. Let's try this. Hang on a second. Let's try that.
All right. Okay, there we go. I wasn't sure if you wanted me to deliver the line again.
No, that's okay. So, in 2014, January 2014, Ray's mascot, not so cleverly named Raymond, was among the nominees for the most prestigious award, Mascot's Most Awesome Mascot, awarded by the Cartoon Network. So he comes in at number 25. It's pretty cool looking. He's pretty cool looking.
I think he's a good, decent mascot.
Yeah.
Not bad.
All right. Bailey. From the, oh, man, Bailey. Yeah, that's L.A. Kings. Bailey's nuts. I can tell you that. He's
a wild man.
Yeah. He looks like a lion. Let's see. In 2014, it went to Bailey from the Los Angeles Kings. In recent years, he's gained a well-earned reputation as a rabble-rouser, having made headlines for his shenanigans on more than one occasion. Last November, Bailey found himself in some hot water after publicly mocking Ducks players battling the mumps. 2 weeks later, he reignited a feud with former WWE superstar CM Punk. Most recently, Bailey took to Twitter to jab at the rival Sharks, remarking that Katy Perry's Super Bowl Sharks were the first to make it to a championship game. Bailey's antagonistic nature elevates him to the next level of mascotting. Why be cute and cuddly where you can be cold and confrontational? That's pretty funny. I like Bailey. All right. We're going to continue here with the power rankings of mascots. And if you have some mascot thoughts or anything, give us a call at 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We're going to break here for some weather, and then we'll come back and jump right back into it. Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. 312-981-7200 if you would like to join us. And we're talking about some pro sports mascots and their power rankings. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Two for Tuesday. Yeah. So. Okay, here is Mark on WGN. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, Nick. Nice to talk to you again.
All right.
Would Andy the Clown of the White Sox just before they left Comiskey. Would you remember him at all?
I do remember Andy the Clown, yes, but he's not around anymore. They've got Southpaw now.
Well, yeah, that I know, but I didn't know if he would be considered a mascot, per se.
He's not really in a mascot outfit. He's dressed up like a clown. But he's not really in a mascot outfit, but he did sort of represent the team. So maybe, in that regard, yeah.
Yeah, I just hung a picture up that we have. My brother and I work for a company. They took us out on a bus. We had a kegger, went there to Comiskey. It was great. And when we moved from Baltimore, we remember being able to see the Sox on Channel 32, UHF.
Yeah.
And Andy the Clown would be there. Anyway, we went there that night, and sure as, and if you remember Andy the Clown, you could hear him from the other side of the ballpark.
Yeah, absolutely. I do remember Andy. Yep.
Yeah. All right. Just thought I'd bring it up.
Thanks,
Love
Mark.
The show.
Take care, man.
You bet.
Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, Andy the Clown. You know who I can't stand? Ronnie Woo Woo. It makes me nuts.
Not a big Woo Woo fan?
No.
And who's the other Mai Tai guy?
Oh yeah, the Mai Tai guy who likes to steal fly balls from kids. Mm. But Ronnie Woo Woo drives me nuts. He's driven me nuts for years. Jeez. Andy the Clown. Well, the Southpaw is a pretty good. I got to say, Southpaw is a pretty good mascot.
Yeah, he's a good man. Good mascot.
Yeah. How about Skates? Look up Skates. Skates is the mascot for the Wolves.
Yeah, I love Skates.
Yeah, Skates is awesome. Skates can skate.
That you
like
know?
He's out there on the ice, man, doing all kinds of jumps and stuff. But yeah, Skates is the Wolves. You can see them out in Rosemont.
Because I never got to go to Blackhawks games growing up. It just didn't happen. I lived too far out. It just kind of like. So I got to go to a lot of Wolves games.
Sure.
I loved it.
Wolves games are great.
They're awesome.
And they're affordable. You can actually, because,
Oh, yeah.
Hawks games are pricey, man. And I would say that. It's worth it. It's absolutely worth it to go to a Hawks game because there's kind of nothing better than going to a Blackhawks game.
Sure.
At the UC. But if you've got, like, a big family, it's very kid-friendly. The players are good. The games are fun. And they've got a lot of activities that happen, in between periods and all kinds of cool stuff for the whole family. And it's affordable. And it's not that far. Rosemont's right out here. It's not far at all.
Mm-hmm. Really make a day of it, honestly.
Oh, I think it's great. There were times when I would go, like my buddy Benji and I, we would go to like a Wolves game in the afternoon and then go to a Hawks game at night. Like we used to do that.
A little doubleheader.
Absolutely, man. Hey, the more hockey, the better as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Yeah. Who are they, the feeder team now? Are they feeding St. Louis?
No. Yeah, they are. Yes, they are.
Because we've got Blackhawks or the Ice
Rockford,
Hogs.
Yeah.
I've always wanted to go to an Ice Hogs game.
I've been. It's great.
Yeah.
All right, let's get back to the pros here. Denver Nuggets, they're Rocky. Their guy is Rocky. He seems to be a feline of some kind. Rocky isn't afraid to go to the extra mile in his performances, sometimes to his own detriment. In November of 2013, he lost consciousness during a stunt. What? A scary moment for fans on hand to witness his limp body lowered from the rafters and laid on the floor. His in-game antics aside, off the court, Rocky has distinguished himself as a rogue political activist.
What?
So he's a gold, he looks like some sort of feline.
Yeah.
And now we have the presidents. They put all the presidents from the Nats games. And that is just, it's hilarious to watch the presidents. Why do I always forget, cause the sausage, obviously that started in Milwaukee with the sausage race, and the sausage race is just
classic.
It's great. It's just great. But why do I always forget the name of the guy who eventually ended up on the Cubs? He was on the Pirates at the time, who hit one of the sausages with a bat as they were running by. He smacked the sausage.
It was Randall Simon.
That's right. I always forget Randall Simon, who eventually ended up on the Cubs. He smacked one of the sausages with a bat.
It's back in like 2006.
And the sausage went down. And it ended up being a girl in the sausage suit. So he smacked a girl with a baseball bat. The Nationals' primary mascot, though, is Screech, an uninspired eagle character who loves the Eagles. The song "Fly Like an Eagle," throwing parties, and subsist mainly on gummy worms and presumably booze. Thankfully, Natty's fans fall back on the racing Presidents, who delight the crowd at home games with their big-headed race during the seventh-inning stretch. So people don't like Screech. All right, how about this? Pittsburgh Steelers. Oh, I love this one. Steely McBeam. Steely McBeam. You got to see this guy. He's like got a hard hat. He's got a steel beam in one hand.
Chiseled jaw of the gods.
Got the fantastic jaw. He's got. By the way, he's got the three-day beard going, too.
Yeah.
He's got the 5 o'clock shadow. Suspenders.
Surprised he doesn't have a Boilermaker in his hands.
Steely McBeam. They did it in 2012. Steely is equal parts terrifying and weird. If you look at him, he is. And it was demonstrated perfectly in the 2012 "Call Me Maybe" parody song "Call Me Steely," and it's a voice that will haunt your nightmares forever. Uh-huh. Nordy. I didn't know that was his name. Nordy is the Minnesota Wild mascot, and he's like a big bear, but he's got like the Wild logo on it. It looks like he's got a tattoo on his face. He's wearing the Wild sweater. But I didn't know his name was Nordy, a humanoid creature of unknown ancestry born somewhere in a forest and discovered skating the frozen ponds and lakes of the state known for 1,000 of them. Nordy's origin story sounds like something out of Marvel Comics than the public relations staff of the Minnesota Wild. Considering how busy Nordy is at Wild games, attending children events, and delivering Valentines, among other things, perhaps this amalgamation of a cat and a bear or something does have superpowers. Nordy. Hugo. The Charlotte Hornets. This is just a weird... It's a hornet. It's like a blue hornet. And he seems to be... He seems to have fallen down in the picture that I'm looking at. The picture that I'm looking at looks like Hugo fell on his butt. Before the Charlotte Hornets became the Charlotte Bobcats and then the Hornets again, an infant wasp named Hugo faced the existential crisis in 1989 when Hurricane Hugo, one of the worst storms on record, devastated the Carolinas. Alas, he survived the fallout, and he is now a mascot of the brand-new NBA franchise. So Hugo is there. He was gone for a little while, but he came back. All right, how about Grizz? This is terrifying. Memphis Grizzlies. It is a terrifying-looking bear. In a Grizzlies uniform with gym shoes and a basketball. This could terrify children. You seeing this thing?
Grizz.
Grizz from the Memphis Grizzlies. It's terrifying. I can't imagine him making children happy in any capacity.
Oh, God.
Yeah. See what I'm saying?
It's like blue.
It looks like a werewolf. Doesn't it look like a realistic looking werewolf? It doesn't look like a mascot. It looks like an actual animal.
Jeez.
Mascots are supposed to be sort of exaggerated, you know what I mean? And goofy looking and fun. This looks like a real animal that will kill you. Doesn't it?
Yeah. It looks like they might have just went into the woods.
Yeah.
And tranquilized a man bear.
Right.
And just
put a uniform on him and threw him on the court. Terrifying. All right, we got a break here, and then we'll come back and talk more about some mascots. If you want to jump in here, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. News is after this. This is one of the weirdest. I think this is one of the weirdest Beatles songs of all time.
It's really good, though.
It's good, but it's really weird. Anyway, I mean, I like it. It's just a weird song. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, 2 for Tuesday. Yeah, man, 2 for Tuesday. Who requested the Beatles?
That's coming to us from Steve H.
Interesting choice, too. So, there you go. All right, welcome back. Hi, everybody. It's Nick DiGilio. We are live in the Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude every weekday morning, 1 to 5. And we're talking about mascots. I'm checking out the Bleacher Report's power rankings of professional sports mascots. And we've got a bunch of texts that are just coming in. If you guys want to call or text us about this, it's 312-981-7200. Jay says, how about Bucky Buckingham Badger? University of Wisconsin. I like that. Be cute and cuddly, but when you can be why and what? But when you can be confrontational, yeah. Have you ever been? No, I haven't. I so want to go. Have you ever been to the Mascot Hall of Fame in Whiting, Indiana? I have not, but I would love to go. Love to go. Dwayne from Elwood says, "What about the mascot for the Joliet Slammers?" Is he a prisoner? Is he, look up the mascot for the Joliet Slammers. Because I know that they're named the Slammers after the prison. That's why they're named Slammer.
His name is J.L. Bird. He's like,
what's he look like?
He's like, I don't know what the type of bird you would call it. It's like black but with an orange beak. But he's wearing, like, you know, the old style prison uniform
with
black
the stripes.
Yeah, and then the little round hat.
That's fantastic.
J.L. Bird.
That's fantastic. J.L. Bird.
But apparently they've got a second mascot who's like a dog.
Is he a warden? What is he, the warden of the prison now?
Yeah, try to figure it out here.
By the way, the Wolves are now the Las Vegas Golden Knights farm team. 312 lets us know. Yeah. 704 area code says, pretty funny mascot story here in Charlotte. Guy went to the beer fest at the minor league ballpark, wandered off and passed out. Woke up hours later, found mascot costume, put it on and hit the streets and bars with people. They bought him drinks. He was high-fiving cops. Google it. That's the Charlotte Knights. That's what they say here. I was Willie the Wildcat for one day.
Really?
In my high school. We were the Luther North Wildcats. Which how many schools have Wildcats for their
my elementary school was the Wildcats, West Wildcats.
Yeah. Yeah, so we were the Wildcat. I was Willie the Wildcat once and only once. Because I ran out on the field, I knocked stuff over. I was generally very obnoxious. So they were like, DiGilio, you are disgracing the Willy the Wildcat costume. And by the way, that costume was ripe. Oh, my God. I remember, just think about it, adolescent boys running around in this thing, and it's barely been cleaned. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
I think Loyola has the weirdest mascot kind of transition. Because right now it's Lou Wolf. He's a wolf, but yeah. We're the Loyola Ramblers.
Oh, right.
So everybody always asks, what the heck's a Rambler? It's not a wolf. And I guess back in the day, the mascot used to be Bo Rambler, a literal homeless person.
Oh,
he was
man.
Like he had like
you can't
the,
get it. He had the stick with the bindle.
Yeah.
So he was a hobo.
He's Bo Rambler.
Wow. How about this? Iceberg from the Pittsburgh Penguins. His name is Iceberg, but he is a penguin. He's a large penguin.
I was kind of hoping it would just be a guy dressed as an iceberg.
Yeah. Mr. Redlegs. This is a great one. This is for the Cincinnati. This is for the Cincinnati Reds. This is the guy who's got the big giant baseball for a head. He's got the crazy hat and a big giant mustache, and he looks insane. He looks completely insane.
His name is Mr. Redlegs?
His name is Mr. Redlegs.
He looks like a crazed gelato salesman.
He does. He looks insane. Mr. Redlegs joined Mr. Red, the official Cincinnati mascot, in 2007 with Gapper creating the haunting trifecta. So there's three of them there. Though Mr. Redlegs is designed to be an exaggerated throwback to the 50s era, the result is hilariously disturbing. It is a little disturbing. Hey, now we're getting local. Benny the Bull.
Yes.
Benny the Bull from the Chicago Bulls. Hey, you remember when one of the people who played Benny the Bull was drunk at Taste of Chicago and got busted?
In costume?
Yeah.
Nice.
He was driving like a scooter or something, or he was I can't remember what it was, but he was driving a vehicle and he like smashed into something and he was drunk. And it's clearly not the same person in the Benny the Bull costume. But Benny the Bull does all kinds of acrobatic stuff. He jumps around.
He's awesome.
He's all over the place. He's great. Benny the Bull is a mascot pioneer of sorts. When he debuted for the Chicago Bulls in the 60s, he was the first NBA mascot to roam the sidelines so that you add barrier breaker to the list of accomplishments. He's an institution. People love him. So he's been around since the 60s, and he does all kinds of crazy stuff, jumping up and down, acting like a lunatic. Let's see. Here's 815 area code says the Arizona Diamondbacks Baxter. What does he look like? Tom, why don't you look up Baxter, Arizona Diamondbacks? He's got to be a snake, right? He's got to be a snake.
No, he is a cat.
Why?
I don't know.
Why is he not a snake?
He appears to be a bobcat.
He's a bobcat? That's a sworn enemy of a snake.
Yeah.
Okay, that doesn't make any sense at all. Okay, Baxter the Bobcat.
How could he be a... I wonder, what would a snake mascot look like? Would he have
a big
legs?
Cobra head? Yeah.
Yeah, like a snake man.
Big cobra head, tongue hanging out.
That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. 847 area code, Stanford's the tree. That's one of the funniest. Have you ever seen this? Have you ever seen this mascot costume? Stanford? Yeah, it is hilarious.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, is it not the craziest thing you've ever seen?
The big, scary, like...
It's a scary, crazy-looking tree. That's the mascot. That's one of my favorites of the mascots that I've seen. How about this? Fred Bird from the Cardinals, from the St. Louis Cardinals. Fred Bird. By the team's own admission, Fred Bird was given a lifelong contract after proving to be so popular. So Cardinals fans, when Fred Bird's production slips and the contract looks like a terrible bet, you know who to blame. So he's not a very, I don't know.
He doesn't even look like a Cardinal.
No.
He's just kind of a generic bird.
He's just Fred Bird. He's a red bird.
Yeah.
How about the Phoenix Suns? The Phoenix Suns gorilla. He doesn't even have a name. Doesn't even have a name. He's the Phoenix Suns gorilla. And he's hanging upside down off the rim in the picture I'm looking at. Like he's just slam dunked the ball upside down through the rim and he's hanging on it.
And again, this is not an exaggerated gorilla.
No.
It's not cartoonish. It looks like a
it looks like a gorilla. With a shirt on, dunking a basketball. Perhaps no mascot is more real, as in real, than the Phoenix Suns gorilla. All the dude does is entertain an arena full of fans doing trampoline-fueled acrobatic dunks through fire in costume. But then he gets unceremoniously canned after kicking a Heat fan at an event. He was admitted into the Mascot Hall of Fame in 2005, even though he kicked a Heat fan.
Well, you know, the Heat fans deserve a good kicking every
It looks like an actual gorilla. I can imagine him just like kicking somebody. It would look like a gorilla. It would look like a gorilla kicking someone. How about this? The Pittsburgh Pirates. Pirate Parrot. Okay, it's like a kind of a neon lime green parrot that looks terrified. Like, he's got this expression on his face like he's completely shocked. He's like, The pirate parrot is a mascot playing with house money in 1979 debut season. The pirate cheered on the last Pirates team to win the World Series, and when the Pirates tried to compensate for more recent failures by stealing another mascot, pirate parrot won. Won by not being the ill-advised Captain Jolly. So they tried to replace the pirate parrot with an actual pirate, Captain Jolly. And that didn't go over very well. And he's got googly eyes that are cross-eyed, but he looks terrified. He looks like someone is, you know, looks like someone's pointing a gun at him. Doesn't he look scared? He looks terrified.
He does.
He's a very, very scared bird.
Just screaming. Wishing he wasn't there.
All right. Let's break here for some weather. And when we come back, we'll wrap up the show and we'll wrap up the whole mascot conversation here. It's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200.
Somewhere in the black mining hills of Dakota, there lived a young boy named Rocky Raccoon. And one day his woman ran off with another guy, hitting young Rocky in the eye. Rocky didn't like that. He said, I'm going to get that boy. So one day he walked into town.
This listener likes weird Beatles songs. Rocky Raccoon is a great song, though.
It is.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Welcome back, everybody. Two for Tuesday just got wrapped up. Yeah! We'll do it again next Tuesday. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. Coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Okay, we've been talking about the power rankings of some pro sports mascots. And it's been a lot of fun looking at some of these and talking about some of them, too. Here's Carl on WGN. Hi, Carl.
Hey, morning, Nick.
Morning.
Hey, up here in Rockford, hockey team, they have Hammy Hog. He's dressed up like a hog in a hockey jersey. He goes on the ice and all that. He really hams it up.
So he hams it up because he's Hammy the Hog.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, there you go. So there's nothing like that. It's nothing like a hog ice skating with his jersey on. All right, thanks, Carl.
Yeah, on two skates also only.
There you go. All right, Carl, thanks.
Thanks.
There you go. Hammy the Hog. Let's see. The University of Texas mascot is Bevo. B-E-V-O. Bevo the Longhorn. Texas A&M years ago branded the Longhorn 13-zip, and the Longhorn name was made. B was made out of 13, the hyphen, was made into an E, and then they added the V and O. Bevo. 815 area code says the Montreal Canadiens, yuppie. Wait a second. The Habs have a yuppie as their mascot? That just seems weird. Okay, we'll have to look that one up. Yuppie for the Habs. I don't understand that at all.
Oh, it's French. It's yuppie.
Oh,
which is like French for yippie, like, you know.
Yippie.
Yeah. And he's just kind of like an orange. He's a guy covered in orange facial hair.
And he's yuppie.
Yeah. Which is French for like, okay, yippie.
Okay. How about Ragnar the Viking? Minnesota Vikings mascot is Ragnar the Viking. It's just a dude in a Viking helmet wearing fur on a motorcycle. It's not even a character. It's not like a costume at all. It's like a fat dude with a beard, with a Viking helmet, a fur coat on, riding a motorcycle, a police motorcycle. This makes no sense at all. Here's what they say about Ragnar the Viking. Minnesota's Ragnar the Viking isn't just the only human mascot on this list. He's the only human mascot in professional sports. Non-costumes mascots have been phased out of sports, probably because they tend to be weird and or creepy, like a goofy dude running around Morgantown with a musket. This one is simply a matter of personal taste. Uh-huh. It's just a dude with a big beard on a motorcycle. Utah Jazz, the Jazz Bear. Okay, well, this is just terrifying right here. Have you seen this one? The Utah Jazz right Jazz Bear?
See, this is the same thing with the Grizzlies.
He looks like a monster, and he's holding... I'm looking at the picture I have. He's holding the kid upside down.
It doesn't even look like he plays jazz.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Utah known for its jazz.
Yeah, big Utah Jazz sound.
You would think they would change the name once when the team leaves New Orleans. You'd think that they would,
yeah,
they would change the name. Utah Jazz Bear has a knack for making mischief and mayhem. He does all the standard NBA mascot stuff, stunts, skits, trick shots. But the bear has developed a distinctly confrontational style that tends to get him noticed more than your average mascot. He does know how to sell it, they say. All right. Wally the Green Monster. Oh, yeah. The Boston Red Sox. this is a good one. Because the Green Monster, for people who don't know, there's the giant wall in the outfield at Fenway. Red Sox mascot Wally the Green Monster hasn't been around as long as some may think. He made his major league debut in 1997. He's long since established himself as perhaps the only likable sports fan in Boston. That's pretty funny. Apparently, he's hated by diehard Red Sox fans, which means he's definitely doing something right. I remember I went to Boston one time, and we went to Fenway. I've been to Fenway a couple times, and I remember we were walking down the street to get to the gate where we were going in to see for Fenway, and I had really long hair. This was like back in 1992, so flannel, long hair, that whole thing. So I had really long hair, and I was just walking past these guys, you know, and I wasn't sporting. I didn't like have Cubs paraphernalia on. I didn't have, you know what I mean? It wasn't like I was clearly an out-of-towner, you know, on somebody else's turf. But we're walking, and these guys are walking, you know, in our path, and you know we're gonna move out of the way, and they walk right. The guy just goes, "Hey, get a haircut." Just said that to me out of nowhere. "Hey, get a haircut." I'm like, "All right, thanks." Okay, here is Bernie, Burnie, Miami Heat. See Bernie, get it? Burn, burn as in burn. I wonder what Bernie did when that gorilla kicked another one of his fans in the face or whatever the hell he did. Did Bernie retaliate?
I love a good mascot fight.
Yeah. KC Wolf. That's the Kansas City Chiefs. He's a big wolf on a four-wheeler. All right. Let's see. Next here, Sausages from Milwaukee. They don't mention Bernie the Brewer? They don't mention Bernie the Brewer, but the Sausages get Mr. Met. Now, this has always been one of my favorites. This is, again, another one that's just a baseball with eyes and a face. Mr. Met.
Yeah, but he looks happy. Unlike,
he does. The other
Mr.
one looked,
Redlegs.
The other, Mr. Redlegs looked terrified. Oh, here's Yuppie. There he is.
Good old Yuppie.
From the Habs, Montreal Canadiens.
Where does Habs come from?
The name of the town where they're from, they call themselves Habitats.
Oh, okay.
So the nickname for Montreal, because they're Habitats, the people who live there are called their Habitats. So the team is nickname is Habs.
Makes sense.
Yeah, I should have explained that, I guess. But I always call them I've been calling them the Habs for my all the time.
Yeah.
The Raptor from the Toronto Raptors.
Oh, not Drake?
No, it's not Drake. Drake is a coffee cake. Jackson DeVille from the Jacksonville Jaguars. He's hanging upside down doing some crazy stuff. And then finally, the number one is the Philly Fanatic. You can't go wrong with the Philly fanatic right there.
The fanatic.
All of this stuff, I think, it really got kicked off. This mascot stuff in pro sports was the San Diego Chicken. Was the sort of the original, like, really unbelievably popular mascot was the San Diego Chicken. And he would go around. He wasn't just in San Diego. He would go around from stadium to stadium and do bits. They would hire him out. So, all right, well, Fanatic, that wins. Philadelphia Phillies Fanatic. Okay, tomorrow on the show, Know Your Onion. We'll do another round of Know Your Onion. It'll be Wild Card Wednesday. And author Mark Larson is going to join us to talk about his book about an oral history of Chicago theater. And this is a big book. So Mark Larson's going to be with us. We'll talk about that tomorrow.